again, friends, and you are my friends, and welcome to another edition of 605, the Super Podcast, the only podcast on Turner Time, the mothership. I am the great Brian Lass, and with me as always, everyone's friend to the end, David Bixenspan. Bix, how are you today?
Okay, I guess.
Santo Gold, what's wrong, man?
I don't know. I'm just not feeling that great. I'm a little under the weather.
Oh, come on. No one wants to hear that.
You were the one who kept going to feed me the question, knowing full well going into this that I was not feeling that great.
Well, hopefully we can make you feel a little better with all the fun stuff we have on this show. We have some really, really cool stuff that
yes,
I think
we do indeed.
Well, I guess we should start with the usual follow-ups. No new updates on Jeff Jarrett's Santo Gold bootleg operation, right, Bix?
I don't think so. I think it was Rob McCarron tweet something about how the first voice you'll hear this week on Shake Them Ropes is Jeff Jarrett, and something about the perfectness or something of that. So I wonder if he decided to be self-deprecating or something. I haven't listened to that yet. If so, that would be
interesting.
Nice. That would be nice.
Yeah, that would be a good move. You think he noticed all the outcry about his attempt to sell people bullshit gold?
I think so.
Santo Gold sitting somewhere right now. Like, God damn it. I knew this would work. No one listened to me. Actually, Santo Gold made money. I guess that's the big difference between him and Jeff Jarrett with this project. But anyway, a few follow-ups to start off the show. Big show. We have a lot of really cool stuff. John McAdam, another part with him coming up. Part three of our Bobby Simmons conversation, where everyone loved, and I think everyone will really dig this part, as well as maybe, Bix, you get to tell me, we'll talk about it again in a little bit, but I think maybe the funniest Dennis of the week we've ever done.
It is the funniest Dennis of the week so far.
It is certainly the one you'll hear the most laughing in the background, because both Bix and myself, usually one or the other loses it. We both lose it throughout the entire thing. And hopefully our laughing doesn't annoy you too much, but it is a fantastic Dennis of the week that everyone will like. So follow-ups. Bix, last week I told a story about the ECW show where I brought a big sign that said Bubba Must Die. It was from the bed sheet at my hotel room that I was at that weekend, that when Dave Shearer and all those guys from the Wrestling Lariat scene and the regulars at the ECW arena were complaining about Bubba Ray Dudley's antics. He was a babyface being shoved down everyone's throat, but he was being a complete asshole to all the local fans. I believe there was some sort of incident with Sign Guy, the ECW sign guy, where he was threatened by Bubba Ray Dudley, and that's why he stopped bringing signs. Because I remember when I held up the sign, actually, I don't think it's on the TV, but when I was there and I held up the sign, he turned around and he gave us a thumbs up and he was smiling. He was happy someone was defending him. Okay. So I bring this.
I know the sign guy story. What I always heard was that he happened to be at the same gym as.
Yeah, I don't believe that story. Mark me down as someone who actually doesn't think that's the story.
Well, I should explain what the story is, though.
Yeah.
That he was at the same gym as, I think, Stevie Richards, right? Is the story, I believe.
Yes, it's Stevie Richards.
He walks up to Stevie or walks by him and says, kayfabe, with the idea that they are rivals because he's the babyface sign guy and Stevie is a heel. And then I feel like I might have actually heard the Bubba part is that that Bubba was the one who threatened him.
Okay, so maybe that is true, but that's the way I remember it from 1996 from being there was Bubba Ray Dudley had threatened him. Bubba Ray was a babyface and he had threatened Sign Guy. And, you know, that was a major part of those ECW shows, those fans and Sign Guy from the earliest days. He was a big, big guy. Like in the watch of early ECW shows, he was probably like 400 pounds and he had his signs. And as he lost weight, he still had his signs and his signs would be incorporated in different things. Like Tommy Dreamer would take his sign. There'd be a stop sign inside. And then he just stopped bringing them all together. And I remember the story being that Bubba Ray Dudley threatened him. And that caused the end of it. So
Actually, wait a second. Wasn't there also that Sign Guy Dudley played into this whole thing too? Or was it what was the story I was thinking of what led to Sign Guy Dudley?
I'm not exactly
sure. Maybe it's all intertwined.
I think I would believe it was all intertwined. You know, it was a very small community. So I bring this sign, Bubba Must Die, on behalf of all the people who are sick of him. It's on the August 6th episode from 1996 of ECW Hardcore TV on the WWE Network. If you want to see, it's a Devon Dudley versus Axel Rotten match where all the Dudleys run in. As soon as Bubba hits the ring, I get my sign out. And it's the only time in ECW history you'll see the Steadicam move closer to try to cut off as much of my sign as possible. You see the shift. You see the zoom. And then, you know, several of us start chanting, Bubba Must Die. He looks at the sign a few times. And that was it. Minor thing, I thought. You know, it was my little moment where I stood up for another fan. Come to find out, one of our listeners sent us, Bix, this video that I guess the Dudleys did a shoot interview years ago. And in the shoot interview, Bubba says the reason he became a heel was because the fans brought a big bed sheet to the show and it said, Die, Bubba, Die, which is wrong. It said, Bubba Must Die, which is what we chanted. And that he used that as the reason to go to Tommy Dreamer and say, hey, look, you guys got to make me a heel. I could really run with this. And then he became a heel. So Bubba Ray Dudley owes me a big thank you and maybe some royalties or something. But yeah, apparently my sign caused the heel turn of Bubba Ray Dudley. How about that?
So you were actually responsible for him finding the role that he always should have had in his career. That's...
Yeah.
He really does owe you. And you are directly responsible for this.
Whenever there's like a Brian Less Wikipedia page, that'll be like one of the things on there. Like, he is directly responsible for the heel turn of Bubba Ray Dudley, who Paul Heyman was trying to shove that everyone started as a babyface. So I got that going for me, which is nice. Next thing we want to talk about on the agenda here is homophobia in wrestling. This is a topic that Bix and I said we were going to be discussing soon. We're not going to be going through it this week just because there's a lot of stuff to compile. And everyone's been awesome. Everyone that goes to facebook.com/superpodcast has been sending over wild clips and ideas of clips that we could look for. And thank you. Everyone who goes up there and is part of that community, you guys are awesome. You guys rock. You guys make everyday fun up on that Facebook page. But there is one I wanted to play today. And it is one I had never seen before. Bix, had you seen this one before?
I don't think so. I mean, I saw the comment and it did not ring a bell, although it amazed me.
Yeah, I don't believe I had ever seen this because I think I would have remembered it. And I would think that you would have remembered it too. So I don't think you probably hadn't also. But we're going to play this quick clip. It's we're going to cut off the interview. You know, we're not going to play the whole 3-minute thing. But here's Lanny Poffo in Memphis in 1984. While his brother Randy Savage and his dad Angelo Poffo are in a ring holding up a sign that says the Rock and Roll Express is dead, here's Lanny Poffo with Lance Russell in Memphis, 1984.
Nobody is. He's an instrument of torture. Lance, I have a very important point to make. It might be a simile or a metaphor, but I think you'll get the message and you can relate it to the people. Listen carefully. Poffomania has something in common with a degenerative disease called AIDS. In both cases, we are turning fruits into vegetables.
Ding, ding, ding.
Because you have chosen to seek power by riding the back of the tiger, in other words, jumping on 6033, then you must pay the price, as Elvis Presley has paid the price, as Marvin Gaye has paid the price, as Janis Joplin has paid the price. All became extinct through their own undoing, and that is what Rock and Roll Express must endure. I am telling you as a threat. I throw poems of love, but in the ring right now is a declaration of war. Poffomania shall bury the Rock and Roll Express. Read what it says. Rock and Roll Express
is dead, boy.
You know what? I spent so much time focusing on the turning fruits into vegetables AIDS diss that I didn't even realize he was just saying that the Rock and Roll Express were going to OD. Like, various. Well, Marvin Gaye didn't OD. Marvin Gaye was murdered by his father. Janis Joplin overdosed. Elvis Presley overdosed. What exactly is he trying to say there, Bix?
That Paul Morton was going to shoot them dead?
Yeah. Yeah, you know, the interesting dynamic here is Randy Savage, the guy you think of as being the crazy guy, is in the ring. It's Lanny. They sent Lanny out there to do this amazing heel promo talking about the death of the Rock and Roll Express and, you know, using AIDS as a nice, funny interlude in the interview. Boy. 1984.
Was that a common, terrible, inappropriate, insensitive joke back then, turning fruits into vegetables about AIDS?
You know, I can't say for I don't know that I know.
I mean,
that
I've never
joke.
Heard it before that I can think of.
Yeah. So Lanny Poffo, you know, there's always so many people who thought there were rumors about him. Go listen to this joke again. Wow.
You will end up like Marvin Gaye.
I would love to have been in the back with Jerry Lawler watching a monitor while this is going on.
Have you ever seen the interviews he did talking about how much he loved doing the genius character because it was fascinating to play on the psychology and the homophobia of the wrestling fans?
No, he said that?
He's talked about stuff like that. I mean, you know, he's a very good interview and shoot interviews and newspaper interviews and stuff. And I'll have to look it up because I think it was like a newspaper interview or something.
At some point, we should get him on the show to talk about ICW. I feel like that would be a real fun conversation. And also, I'd like to – I'm really, you know, not just for my 83 book project, but I'm fascinated with what was going on with the Poffos at the end of 83, where Lanny's in Mid-South on the undercard. George Weingroff, who had been an ICW regular, is in Mid-South on the undercard. They're building up Randy Savage coming in, which never happens because the deal between Poffo and Jarrett happens. They're also building up Savage on Georgia TV, I believe, around this time. So
– Well, and he worked Georgia because he was in the tag team tournament, although I don't think he was ever on TV.
That's right. He was in the Thanksgiving 83 tournament, right?
Yes. With okay. Who was his partner?
Magnum TA?
Was it Magnum? Yeah, it was Magnum. That's right. Because
yeah.
That played into the whole Wrestling 2 Magnum storyline. That's like, why are you aligning yourself with these Poffos?
Oh, I forgot about that. Wow.
So that was all intertwined.
Well, there'll be a lot more.
Busted out intertwined in the last few minutes.
Well, there'll be a lot more about Mr. Wrestling 2 later on in this show in the Bobby Simmons interview. I think everyone's going to really, really like that. If you've ever wondered how big Mr. Wrestling 2 really was in Georgia, you'll get your answer today. But moving along from AIDS and wrestling, boy, what a topic that is. Sue the Shooter. We have a follow-up on Sue the Shooter. One of our listeners.
What a segue that was. Moving along from AIDS and wrestling. A sexually promiscuous woman.
You know, I didn't even make that connection, and now I feel awful. Sue, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Turning fruits into vegetables.
So one of our listeners, a very, very nice guy, Steve Ogilvy, who actually got this from Bob Barnett, another friend of ours. So if anyone wants it, Bob Barnett may still have it. You can get in touch with him. He sent us the documentary Love Struck. The documentary about Sue the Shooter. Sue Shooter, her real name, not Sue the Shooter, the name we've given her that's taken off. But Love Struck is the story of Sue and everything she experiences with wrestling. I zoomed through it real quick. I haven't had a chance to watch it, but there she is at the airport greeting and hugging Jerry Lawler, calling him on the phone on his birthday while holding an action figure of Jerry Lawler in her hand. Lots of interesting things it looks like in this movie. And like I said, thank you, Steve Ogilvy, for sending it over. And he got it from Bob Barnett. Bob will be on the show at some point soon because there's a lot of stuff we want to talk to him about. But you can reach out to Bob if you want a copy, if he still has it. I'm not exactly sure.
Why does it not surprise me that Bob had a copy of this?
Hey, I wish I had a copy of it. I'm surprised I didn't have a copy of this.
I'm surprised that it never really floated around. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't something I'd really heard about. And I knew about this article, obviously, for many years. I sat on it. And, you know, once we started doing the podcast, I had a forum to read it. But, you know, I've known about her and this article for years, and I just didn't know there was a documentary. And, you know, a lot of people have gotten in touch with us from Australia. We have a lot of listeners down there, surprisingly. And they all say, you got to see the movie. You got to see the movie. And now we're going to be able to see the movie. So we will have a review for this movie. The Siskel and Ebert version of the 605 Super Podcast pretty soon. It'll probably take us a couple weeks to get through it, but that'll be coming up. Next, we have something I've been looking forward to, Bix. Jimmy Snuka.
Oh, no.
There was a range of emotions in your sounds there. A while back, we read an article on the air from Fiji with Love about Jimmy Snuka, and it was filled with just these I believe, what was it called? What did the guy call it? Mysteric yammerings from the South Pacific or something. And it made no sense. And I mentioned that I wanted to find the transcript of his 1983 acceptance speech for the Wrestler of the Year for Victory Magazine. One of our listeners was amazing enough to send it over. And that's Adam Annapolis. Adam, thank you. I think Adam and I may start a project soon, the Jimmy Snuka transcription project, where we try to get as many.
Adamapolis?
I thought it was Adam Annapolis.
I thought it's Adamapolis.
If I messed up your name, I'm sorry.
I know who you're talking about.
Yeah, I thought it was Adam Annapolis. Like Annapolis, Maryland?
Okay.
All right, we'll find out who's right and who's wrong. How are we going to settle it?
Isn't he on Twitter?
Go look on Twitter.
Adam and talk while I
look. Okay. Yeah, thank you very much. So I'm going to read this. This is the, again, from Victory Magazine, right. I'm right. Hey, now you talk for a second.
Talking for a second.
So I can get a swig of water for the Jewish man. Okay. I could do Sue the Shooter all day. It's not fair you hitting me with that while I'm drinking the water. You motherfucker. All right, so I'm going to read this. I got to try to get into my Snuka voice. It's not the best, but he wasn't screaming this. This was a very subdued promo. But it ends up making – he ends up stringing together one sentence at the end, but everything else is just the most amazing run-on sentence of all time that goes like everywhere and nowhere. All right, let me read
everywhere
this.
And nowhere, brother.
I just want to mention one thing. I'll tell the wonderful people out there in TV Wonderland that I want to thank you very much and so kind, deep down in your hearts, to have that feeling, to fulfill myself and you people for representing such a thought and the beautiful mind, deep and so wonderful that it's so hard to try to even explain more than I could ever give to you. This is my loveness. And the faith of my belief is what I can give you is to thank you for your kind honor, which it may be. I might not have a belt around my waist, but it's just a thought in mind that the beautiness of the kindness from the heart will tell you who you really are. And I want to thank you very much again, ladies and gentlemen. And I hope we all have a beautiful 1984. Thank you, and I love you very much. And that's Jimmy Snuka receiving the 1983 award for Wrestler of the Year. The Loveness. That's my favorite part.
I think that's going to be the title of this episode.
The Loveness?
Yeah. Maybe not.
That might win. What's that exact line again? Let's go back to this. It's hard to even know where to start. It's all one sentence, like with commas. To fulfill myself and you people for representing such a thought and the beautiful mind, deep and so wonderful that it's so hard to even explain more than I could ever give to you is my loveness and the faith of my belief is what I can give to you to thank you for your kind honor, which it may be. I might not have a belt around my waist, but it's just a thought in mind that the beautiness of the kindness from your heart will tell you who you really are.
Okay. I mean, so it should be this is my loveness.
This is my loveness. This is going to be the second week in a row we actually get the show title while we're doing the show. We're going to have more. There'll be more Jimmy Snuka transcript readings. Not related to trial. Coming up on 605, the Super Podcast. Sorry for my Jimmy Snuka if it's not that good, but you all get the point. I do want to mention that I have finally got my hands on the book Bruiser that Scott Teal recently put out, and I have not had a chance to look over it yet. And I intend to read the entire thing. And once we're done, we're going to do a big special here on the show. Well, not a big special, but a segment reviewing the book and talking about the life of Dick the Bruiser. The book is written by Richard Vysik. Do you remember how to pronounce this, Bix?
Didn't it end up being Vysik?
Vysik. Richard Vysik, edited by Scott Teal. And it's a book all about Dick the Bruiser. Of course, Dick the Bruiser, one of the most famous professional wrestlers of all time, one of the biggest heels of all time, also a promoter. And, you know, legendary guy, Bix, right?
Yes. Also, as it turned out, legendarily homophobic.
Was he?
But what did he do? Well, I guess you don't have to be homophobic. You just have to be exploiting homophobia to steal Jim Barnett's territory by threatening to out him.
Oh, well.
I only brought that up as to tie into what we were talking about earlier. Go on.
Yeah. Well, let me say this. One of the things in this book.
I didn't mean to kill the moon.
No, that's all right. Homophobia does that every time, Vix. One of the things I want to read about in this book is, you know, Bruiser was involved in one of the most famous matches in wrestling history. It was Dick the Bruiser and Dr. Jerry Graham against Antonino Rocco and Eduardo Carpentier at Madison Square Garden, which, of course, caused a riot. I mean, a bloody riot. Chairs and cops getting hurt and blood everywhere. And it led to the Athletic Commission having a trial or a hearing about this. And that was the reason why fans weren't able to attend Madison Square Garden under the age of 14 up until the early 70s. It was all because of this one match in, I want to say 58. It could be 57 or 59, but I think
I was thinking 57, but I think it's 57 to 58 is the right range, yes.
Right, it's somewhere in there. So that's in this book. And like I said, you can all check it out now. It's at crowbarpress.com. If you purchase it there, let Scott know that you heard about it here on 605. He's a friend of the show. You remember him. He was on before. He'll be on again. And this is a really cool book from just going through it really quickly. And once I am able to go all the way through it, we will do something on the show about it. But check it out. Crowbarpress.com. Bruiser by Richard Vysik and edited by Scott Teal. Next, I want to mention something that doesn't really have anything to do with classic wrestling. But one of our listeners, Jeff Luxon, brought this up to me, and I felt like this merited some time here on the show. Joe Doering, a 12-year veteran of pro wrestling and a mainstay in All Japan Pro Wrestling since 2007. He was a Triple Crown champion, one of the few Americans to ever win the Triple Crown championship. He won it in 2014. He was recently diagnosed with stage 3 brain cancer. He was actually diagnosed on February 25th of this year, and he's having a little bit of a rough time. And I want to plug the GoFundMe page where they're raising money to help him with his treatment and everything that's that he's going through right now. It is GoFundMe.com/Joe Doering. That's GoFundMe.com/Joe Doering. GoFundMe.com/Joe Doering. You know, each week here on the show, Bix and I mention that we have a donation tab where you can donate some money to us through PayPal to help us keep the show going, show some support. I'm going to ask this week if anyone's considering doing that, don't, and instead give the money to Joe Doering, because he could certainly use it a lot more than we can right now. And let's all keep him in our thoughts and hope for the best. But again, it's GoFundMe.com/Joe Doering. Let's help him out in his time of need.
Yeah, and we'll also have the link in the show description too.
Absolutely, absolutely. And you know, unfortunately, I haven't seen too much of his work just because, you know, I got to the point where I tuned out of All Japan Pro Wrestling, but I've only heard good things about him.
About the same. I mean, I tuned out like a couple of years before he came over there, but I heard nothing but good things about him as a worker and just shitty situation either way. So help him out.
Yeah, help him out. And let's all just keep him in our thoughts and hope for the best. And hopefully something good will come out of this. Hopefully everything will work out. You never know. You truly never know. We'll follow this up with something better than the homophobia sue the shooter follow-up segment. T-shirts. 605 t-shirts will be made pretty soon. Now, here's what I need from you guys. I know some of the people on our Facebook page chimed in, but I created a post the other day on Facebook asking everyone who's actually interested in buying the first run of 605 t-shirts, which will be just the logo on a black shirt. Pretty simple, before we do any crazy artwork or any slogans from the show or anything. If you're interested in buying the shirt, let me know what size you are, just because I'm trying to gauge exactly what I should order. I'm not going through a ProWrestlingTees.com or any of that other stuff. We're going to do it on our own and handle it on our own, just like we've done everything else with this show, quite frankly. So if you are someone interested in a 605 t-shirt, the post is on the Facebook page. It was from a couple days ago. So, you know, this show comes out Thursday. It was either Monday or Tuesday. You can go look for it and just chime in with your size. Only if you're serious about buying a shirt, just because I want to make sure we don't, you know, order 1,000 large and, you know, everyone saying I want, you know, 2XL and then we end up sitting on them. So just if you're interested in a 605 shirt, which is coming, just let us know. Keep us posted on that.
And I think I'll link the Facebook post too on Twitter or something, just to make sure that everyone sees it if by some chance you haven't joined the Facebook group. And I don't want us to end up with a bunch of mediums, because that you always hear stories like that. So,
yeah, in fact, I mean, Dominic Valente, who we've mentioned recently on the show, and we played that Sailor Art Thomas audio. You know, he had the free wrestling hotline. The free wrestling hotline. Quite controversial at times, from what I gather, from what I've heard from a few people. But I remember in the mid-90s, Dominic ordered like, I could be wrong. I'm just going to throw this out of the way I remember it. He ordered like 500 yellow t-shirts that said Pro Wrestling King of Sport and didn't sell any of them. And they were all in his garage. Like, he just thought they would fly out by like hotcakes. And they didn't. So I think he may actually still have them. Maybe we should buy his stock for like pennies on a dollar and resell them.
Did he have them printed up or did he buy them from Boyd Pierce?
No, he definitely had them made on his own.
Because that was Boyd Pierce's thing. All yeah, Pro Wrestling. That said Pro Wrestling King of Sports, and he'd sell them to indie promotions and stuff.
I think obviously that's where he got the idea. He probably saw it in an old wrestling magazine and said, hey, that's pretty good. I'll do that. And then look what happened.
That sounded nothing like Dominic.
It sounded like him in 1996, maybe a little more than it does him now. But one last
thing. Who would win a match?
Jose from Brooklyn wants to know who'd win a match between Dick the Bruiser and Wee Willie Wilson. Wee Willie's got a lot of speed, but I'll have to go with the Bruiser.
Yeah, that was it. Nothing like
when you'd call his hotline, he would do that. Like, people would just ask him like who would win matches, and it would tell you a lot about his audience.
That was a thing that the callers drove. That was not him. That was his listenership.
That was him just going through every voicemail he got and just reading them on the air. Absolutely. So, one last follow up. Boy, this has become like the search for the Holy Grail. Mark Lean. We have had leads. We have had leads disappear. We've been working really hard on getting Mark Lean on the show. Terry Garvin Sims, his former tag team partner in Beauty and the Beast, has also gone out of his way to try to help us get in touch with Mark and get Mark on the show. So far, we've had no luck whatsoever. However, we are still actively trying to make this happen, and I think we may have some hope. We may have some new leads. You'll hear more about this next week, but we're still very hopeful. We're still working on it. I know this has just been like a giant tease forever, but I wouldn't have this on the show, and Bix wouldn't have it on the show if it wasn't something we legitimately thought could happen. So stay tuned. Mark Lean, we hope.
This man is totally awesome.
Will he be on the show, Bix?
You will see him in the coming week.
Oh, will he have anyone with him? Oh, come on.
Mamba, the jungle savage.
What does Larry Nelson think about this whole ordeal? There's going to be an interesting stipulation when he's on the show. No, you don't have that one? Oh.
No, I don't have it. I'm just not going. Do we really need to keep up with the charade?
What's the stipulation?
There we go. What was that?
I accidentally pressed the key for the blaster segment because I still had it loaded into the soundboard.
All right. Well, I think that's a nice transition to this week's Super Podcast Super Universe Top 10. Are you ready, Bix?
I guess so.
Some big changes this week on the top 10.
Good. I hope Akeem Vixen's fan did very well.
Well, sorry to break that to you. He did not make the top 10 this week. Surprisingly, I'm shocked he didn't, because I thought after last week he definitely would have.
What about the Hangman? Is he in there?
Well, we'll get there.
Okay.
Number 10, Robbie 5.
Is this his first?
Number 9. This is his first week making the list, yeah, because this is the first week he was eligible.
Okay, good. I think Robbie 5 deserves to be there.
I was surprised the Kayfabe Cops only got a couple of votes. I thought they would make it, but you never know.
We need Kurt Brown to campaign for the Kayfabe Cops.
Yes, he was actually one of the two votes for the Kayfabe Cops. I remember that. Number 9, El Pibe Diaz, 83. Number 8, Denim Fritz Von Erich, who I think is my favorite of all the candidates.
I hope he falls out of the top 10 next week.
Why do you hate Denim Fritz so much?
I just don't get it.
It's Fritz coming out of retirement and insisting on wearing all denim. There's something just hysterical about it.
He wore more than just denim. He had the old man button-up shirt.
That was a denim shirt.
That was not a denim shirt.
It was all denim.
No, it wasn't.
Do you remember the famous story? He went to the NWA convention with his kids, and he was like, I just want to tell everyone, one day,
all five of my boys are going to wear denim.
You remember that famous story? I think it was in Las Vegas. You just hate him. It's just, you have an irrational hatred. Well, actually, I shouldn't say you hate him the most, because number seven, the Black Scorpion.
Bix. Bix. How you feeling?
You stupid idiot!
Remember the doctor's office.
I could do Sue the Shooter all day. Number six, Orgasmic Larry Nelson. Number five, I was surprised by this one. Fake Stan Lane.
Very good.
He all of a sudden really popular with our listeners.
Is he the only pro wrestler ever to be trained by fake Ric Flair?
Yeah. I wish there was a way we could do more, another segment on it, but what else is there to uncover in that story?
I guess we could contact the widow, fake Stan Lane.
there's something so wrong about that, yet I really want to do it. Could contact fake Steve Kern, or maybe get the real Stan Lane on, just tell his side of the story.
That actually sounds like a good idea.
Maybe we should try to get Stan Lane on the show. I may know a guy who knows him.
So, I wonder who that could be.
I'll ask. It's a fake Bobby Eaton, of course. Fake Stan Lane was actually in a tiebreaker runoff he lost to number four, the Hangman, Bruce Poban's.
There we go.
Now, Bix, I sent you a file of Hangman Bruce Poban stuff. Have you had a chance to go through any of it?
Not yet. It's very, what's the word? How do you pronounce it? Having a lot of volume. Voluminous?
Voluminous.
Voluminous, yes.
Not voluptuous, but voluminous.
No, that's Susan Shooter.
Well, I don't know how voluptuous she is. Come on now.
No, that's what? Voluptuous? What's voluptuous?
I don't know. I think you screwed me up.
Of course I did.
Well, the point is there's going to be a lot more Hangman Bruce Poban's potentially to come.
Good.
So we're going to go through this stuff. This isn't going to be imminent because, like Bix said, there's a lot of stuff there. So we're going to go through it and see what we could find. But I feel like the top of this top 10 is really awesome. Number three, Marcoline. Marcoline was number
three. This man is totally awesome.
He was number three last week as well. So he actually maintained his spot. The popularity of Marcoline. I hope that if we actually can get him on the show, it could be like the week he hits number one. Like, that would be perfect.
I have a surprise coming for you.
What's that? What, Bixie?
Your mamba!
Number two.
I haven't memorized all the keys yet.
Number two, Sue the Shooter. The highest placement she's had yet on the top 10. I could do Sue the Shooter all day. Don't make me whip out the Black Scorpion again, Bix.
Is that a euphemism?
Yeah, you know what? Now that I said that, there you go. There's your next drop. Boy, the things that come out of my mouth. There's another one. Number one, I am proud of this one, Bix.
Okay.
Number one, Santo Gold. Santo Gold. He's got the gold, baby.
Santo Gold, Santo Gold.
I really want to play that song on the air so much, and I'm so afraid that that's the one guy who will sue us.
Who? Santo Gold? Santo Gold?
Santo Gold. One of our listeners said they actually got in touch with him through his website, but he didn't respond. But they're like, you have to go on 605. And he does. He has to come on 605 so we can talk more about it.
Well, I would presume that Professor Ouch was in touch with him to have ordered the behind-the-scenes DVD from him.
Oh, yeah. You know, I should ask him exactly where he got it, Professor Ouch, because he was the one who prompted this whole Santo Gold phenomenon here on 605. But now, the big title match, the Slip House Boys versus Yo Mamba the Jungle Savage. Last week, the Slip House Boys went over Orgasmic Larry Nelson. And this week, we have a new champion, Yo Mamba the Jungle Savage.
Yo Mamba the Jungle Savage.
He's totally awesome. And
this man is totally awesome. Totally awesome.
Well, two totally awesome.
Totally awesome.
How many in a row can you do?
This man is totally awesome. Totally awesome. Totally awesome. Totally awesome.
Okay, okay. So next week, the Slip House Boys are eligible for the top 10. As always, the top 10 voting goes up Thursday afternoon, and you can vote until Monday. And all the various cult favorites of the 605 Super Universe are eligible. If you have suggestions of others who should be eligible, you could send it to us. But the entire list of candidates will be up, and Thursday afternoon you can vote. Slipphouse Boys will be in the running to get back in the top 10. We'll see. It'll be interesting to see how they do next week. So with that, it's time to move on to the Dennis of the Week. Bix, I think this, like I said before, the funniest Dennis of the Week we've had yet.
It definitely is. And not just for the main story, but for the little side story that comes at the end, which I guess we'll talk about
after. On the other side. Yeah. We had Tom Robinson back with us. Tom was one of our very first Dennis's of the Week, actually, and a good friend of the show and one of the funniest people we've talked to. And you're going to definitely be hearing him on the show a lot more in the future, not just with the Dennis of the Week, but just on the show. He is just, first of all, he could do everyone's voices. You'll hear it'll either be next week or the week after. We do some more stuff with Tom, and he does a conversation between Taz and Sabu, and he gets both guys' voices down like right away. It's amazing.
This guy not just their voices, the rhythm of their speech, everything.
Yeah, it's astounding. It's truly a talent.
Who has a Sabu impression besides Tom Robinson?
I often have said that if we were able to make this like, you know, a regular, you know, daily morning show, like I would have Scott Cornish as one of my writers, like my Jackie Martling. I think I'd have Tom in the studio as the Billy West, you know, just doing voices and having like a Sue the Shooter puppet or something that could do voices.
Wouldn't that mean he would have a Scott Cornish puppet technically?
Oh yeah, I guess so. I guess so. I got to find out where they sell those. But this week's Dennis of the Week has something very interesting. We've heard little hints about this in the past. I know Jim Cornette has brought it up. I think a few other people may have. But today you're going to hear more about the relationship between Dennis Caraluzzo and Kenny Starmaker Bolin, before he was a Starmaker, when he was just Kenny the Fan Bolin. So with that, enjoy this week's Dennis of the Week. By popular demand, back on the 605 Super Podcast for the Dennis of the Week is Tom Robinson, a very popular guest here on the program. Tom, how are you today?
Doing good. What's up, Bri? What's up, Bix?
Well, you know, your name has come up a lot lately. Your name came up with John McAdam on the show. Your name came up with Jamie Ward on the show, two longtime friends of yours. I guess you knew Jamie a little bit longer, both being from the Philadelphia area, correct?
Correct. And I heard I was a registered sex offender brought up as well, but I don't want to bring that up. Yeah, Jamie I knew forever. I worked at a local strip mall kind of deal, and we – actually, trivia, useless trivia, Chubby Dudley, A. Ragney, worked there as well. It was called The Bazaar. And when there was a wrestling fan in that era, like we worked in three different parts, but word got back to each other that we were involved. So we became friends quickly, the three of us. Yeah. And McAdam, guy's been chasing my tail forever.
Well, you know, one of the things that came up in conversation, I believe with Jamie a few weeks back, was he said, if you talk to Tom again, ask him about when him and Dennis crashed a wedding. So this is a story, obviously, I didn't know. So I've been very excited to hear it. What's the story behind that?
Well, if you have regular listeners of the Dennis of the Week, Dennis was a unique character and had fun without alcohol as well, which was strange to me. He did the kind of things you hear somebody under the influence would do, but I was reminded today by Joe Lilly, who was there. He was, the Piss Boy moniker was given to both of us from Kenny Bolin and Dennis. The four of us were doing the loop with the wrestling radio trip, and we were staying at whatever hotel, and there's a wedding, and there's food, and there's happiness, and family, and friends, and Dennis says to Kenny, I'm fucking hungry, man. And Kenny's like, well, let's go ahead in. And I was like, you guys got to be kidding, right? We were like 17, 18 years old, Joe and I. And we went in, and there was an open table with some family members. It was like four and four open seats. And sure enough, we're eating the chicken marsala and stuff like that. And we're having a good time. I was underage. I would have rated the beer now. But Dennis is talking as if he knows, but he's trying to get the names of the bride and groom. Saying stuff like, yeah, we've been friends for forever. I'm so happy to see her happy. And, like, he was just egging them on to say, like, you know, William and Joyce or something are so happy together. But we couldn't get the name. And they were coming around to the tables and stuff like they do to see their guests. And Joe and I were in full panic mode, but Kenny and Dennis are pros at this. So they were like, all right, we got to ditch this table, but I got an idea. So Dennis went up to the DJ booth and he didn't grab the microphone. He asked first, but he said, can I get everybody's attention? The unity of marriage, this is not verbatim, but something like that. the sanctity of marriage is so sacred and one I greatly respect, and I've never seen a more beautiful couple. He gets a standing O. And he says, I just want to play, I think he played Always and Forever or something from Heat Wave. And, you know, we ended up at another table stealing some more food, and then we got the fuck out of there before they could figure out who we were.
Man, I mean, that's just it's just amazing. That's just completely that's something Dennis would do, that only Dennis would be able to get away with so smoothly.
Yeah, at that point in time, when you put Dennis and Kenny Boland together, it's one of those things where I'm sure you guys had to go on in your own lives where it's like the greatest fucking thing ever, but you don't realize it till afterward, you know.
Yeah.
Those two guys had such, at times, demonic chemistry, but just hilarity ensued whenever they were together.
How often were you around them? Any other stories of being with the both of them together?
Oh, yeah. First, I saw a video from, I just had a foot cramp, sorry. First, I saw a video of Jim Cornette's wedding to Kelly. And it was Dennis and Brian Hildebrand and maybe Norm Dooley or Walt Wolanski. I don't know if those names are familiar.
Sure.
And Kenny Bowen. And Kenny and Dennis obviously stood out with Jimmy as the funny people that were being interviewed. And then Kenny, I think, lived out in Knoxville, maybe at that time. I don't know, somewhere outside of Memphis, but he met us. And myself, Kenny, Dennis, Gabrielle Bolin, who is no longer married to, and Chris, the prince, who was about 1 year old at the time, maybe two. We went to an all-you-can-eat buffet or something of that nature in the Grand Ole Opry. Not the actual music facility, but just Opryland around that area in Nashville. And Kenny and Dennis start kicking me under the table and starting, this is mid-meal. And I wasn't getting what they were saying. And Dennis, like, leans over and says, we're fucking out of here. We ain't paying for nothing, pissy. And, you know, I never know what to expect. And Kenny's like, just follow us. And one of the time, I think Kenny got up first and sold that he was going to the bathroom, and out the front door he went. And then there's Dennis. He starts rolling. So it's me, Gabrielle Bowen, who I've never met, and an infant. And I had a net worth of about $27. And those fucking guys left, and they shoot left. And Kenny smartened his wife up to get out of anything he does, I guess. So I was like, fuck this, man. I left too. So the maitre d' catches on when I leave. Kenny had went first, so he already got his car. And Dennis, at some point, I wasn't there to view when he got it, but he found a chef's hat on his way out. And he puts the chef's hat on to cover his bald head. to try to like fit in with all the crowd of Opryland. And I was skinny as a rail, so it was easy for me to hide. But I see this maitre d' cursing and God knows Armenian or something, you know, some language that I didn't understand. And he was hot. And it was like a Three Stooges episode, because Dennis with the chef's hat on is behind a pillar with four sides. And Dennis can run about 300 pounds at that point, so he could barely fit behind one. And the visual of seeing him in the chef's hat, hairy forearms and with his mustache and 300 pounds. And this guy is like, I could see it. And Dennis is making eye contact for me to give him signals, so to speak. And I kept like kind of pointing where the guy was, and he would like tiptoe to the other side of the pillar. And it was like, it was out of like vaudeville where the guy never saw him. And then when the guy went back towards the restaurant for like two paces, Dennis like started trucking at 300 pounds with the chef's hat, and the chef's hat came off like, you know, I don't know, Jimmy Rollins stealing a base when his baseball cap falls off. And I start running as well. And Kenny Bowen's out there, and he never drove stick or some shit. And he bought a car because he's always looking for a deal that was stick shift. And it's just like, and he's like screeching across this Opryland parking lot. And Dennis gets in, and it was like I had this little opening because Dennis closed the door on me, and I dove in like Dukes of Hazzard, and we get the fuck out of there. And I'm like, what are you guys fucking doing? I said, your wife and kid are in there, man. The Kenny. And he's like, ah, she knows what to do. I never pay for food. And they just acted like, I heard it made Kenny's book as well. I got a good copy of that. So Kenny, if you're listening, I want a comp. But yeah, that was my introduction to Kenny Bowen and Dennis, and quite an introduction. And supposedly Gabrielle said I just met those guys, and she never had to pay either. She said they invited me and my son to breakfast or what have you. And you know, but she was pissed at Kenny and gave him an earful, but she got out of it without paying as well.
Were they around each other a lot, Dennis and Kenny?
Anytime they could. I mean, in one of the past Dennis's of the week, I heard Cornette talk about a certain shopping spree that occurred, if you guys remember.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. There may allegedly have been a lost credit card, which led to a shopping spree.
Yeah. Dennis, for whatever reason, had butterfingers with his credit card, and Kenny was around, and we'll just use allegedly, just edit in allegedly after everything I say. We went, and Kenny bought a camera. Kenny bought stuff for his infant, stuff for his wife, stuff for the Piss Boys to match so we could hang around with them because they were heels. And we were like kids that were, they were kayfabe, and then we could only be their Piss Boys to allow us to hang with such greatness. But they gave us matching like striped red shirts, and they got matching striped blue and white and red and white polo shirts. So you know, we wore clothes to the Mid-South Coliseum and stuff like that. And Kenny made some fine video of the trip, and then all of a sudden Dennis realized his credit card was stolen and called it in, and what can you do? And that's hence the name Credit Card Kenny that he had for a while. I think Kenny might have stole my, did an identity theft on me one time as
Wait,
well.
What?
He called me out of the blue, like, you know, a year later, and he's like, hey man, you working? And I'm like, I got a bad Kenny impression. If I heard him talk, I could do it. But I said, yeah, man, I'm driving for some company, making $10 an hour. This is, I don't know what year, but it was decent for me. $10 an hour. That's great. I might move up there. Listen, I need your social security number for, and I gave it to him because whatever he was pitching sounded like accurate, and I was young and dumb. And next thing I know, I checked my credit report and I got houses in Louisville and shit. I was like, this is legit. I mean, there was like, I'm exaggerating with the Louisville, but my credit report was like, had so much stuff that I didn't own. Like I'm like 19 or 20 and I had a house that I didn't have. I had cars from, you know, Yahoo, Toyota, you know, and meanwhile, I'm driving my mom's car and living at home. So couldn't get approved for shit. So that's just speculation, but I still love him anyway. Kenny's my boy. And, you know, Dennis and him together, as I said, were just priceless. You know, Cornette would back that up.
Well, hopefully you don't think we misled you. Hopefully you laughed as hard during that as Bix and I did. We couldn't control ourselves, Bix.
Yes, and also, just to give a little view behind the scenes, it probably also helped that, for once, both of us weren't constantly muting ourselves.
No, I left the thing open, and Tom was just... There's nothing that's ever made me laugh that much so far, I don't think.
No, me neither. If not just for the whole vision of Dennis wearing a chef's hat. Hiding behind the pillars, poking his head out, seeing if it was all safe to go. And then at the end, it's just, oh, by the way, once Kenny called me and asked for my social security number.
You know, the visual of Dennis in the chef's hat is funny. But to me, what makes it over the top funny is that it's Dennis when he had the mustache. Like, for whatever reason, that to me puts it way over the top. If it had been Dennis after he had shaved, not as funny. But Dennis with the mustache, it makes it 100 times funnier. And I have a feeling we're going to be seeing some Travis Heckle artwork of this pretty, pretty soon. I have a hunch. And, you know, on the topic of Kenny Bolin, we're going to hear more from Tom Robinson, if not next week, the week after, but definitely again real soon. But on the topic of Kenny Bolin, Bix, book of the week.
Book of the week. So, disclaimer, I have not actually read this whole book yet, but we kind of figured that this had to be the book of the week.
Absolutely.
The book of the week is I Probably Screwed You Too, The Mostly True Stories of Kenny Starmaker Bolin, which of course you can get at Amazon in both hard copy and Kindle form. And if you get it, please, well, you know what? I'll get to that in a minute. Let's talk about the book first. So this is, I guess it's not a traditional autobiography. It's all of the different Kenny Starmaker Bolin tales. And the first thing I'll say right out of the bat, You get what I'm trying to say.
I guess it would be off the bat.
Right off the bat and out of the gate, yes.
There you go.
So, at the beginning, I should tell you, if you don't like the Kenny Starmaker Bolin persona you have heard on the Jim Cornette Experience, disregard that, I would say. Would you agree? Just in general, with his universe of stories. I know you haven't checked out the book yet.
Yeah. Oh, I think I haven't checked out the book yet. I am going to get it because I'm just positive it's great.
So I downloaded the sample to my Kindle. I read that all in one shot and immediately bought it and kept reading it. It's really, really fun. It's also not just a traditional autobiography in the sense that there are comments sprinkled throughout from Jim Cornette, Kenny's siblings, other people, you know, wrestlers, etc. Like, I already spotted a comment from Rico Costantino. It's a lot of fun, and I get the feeling there's going to be a lot more coming up. And apparently the whole wedding crashing story with Tom Robinson is in the book in some form. So I'm very curious to see Kenny's version of that in print. And if you want to get the book and support the show, now there are a couple different ways to do it that we'll explain. This all involves our Amazon referral link, which we'll talk about in general. If you're buying anything from Amazon and you want to support the show, it doesn't cost you anything extra. Go to tinyurl.com/605Amazon. just add the stuff to your cart after you go there, and we get a little percentage of what you order. Again, you don't pay anything extra, but it goes to us. And Brian, what do you say about the bigger name podcasts that push the same thing?
Hey, it's bigger name podcasts. It's regular size podcasts. Any other podcasts?
The big
there.
Name ones.
Hey, it's all of them. Listen, you listen to this show. You know how much work we put into this, and you know how much fun you have listening to it. So when you think about which Amazon referral link to use, just remember, fuck those guys.
Now, that said, if you are curious to check out the book and you want to help us out,
Those guys.
Yes, but you're not sure if you want to spend the $10 or whatever to get it. We have an alternative for you, because that book is available on Kindle Unlimited, which is Amazon's monthly subscription service that includes various Kindle titles, which you can use on the Kindle devices or on the Kindle app, which is available on any kind of computer, tablet, phone, etc. And you can do a free trial through our whole referral thing. And for that, you go to tinyurl.com/605Kindle. Even if you cancel before the end of the 30-day free trial, so you could cancel right away, or if you want to check out the book and other stuff, you could cancel later, or not cancel, whatever, it's all the same to us. We get the same little kickback. So I would say that is a perfectly fine way to try the book if you want to check it out. Would you agree, Brian?
I agree. Come on, hook a brother up. It costs you nothing. It'll help us out. That's a way you can support the show without actually having to spend any money on Amazon or donating or buying a t-shirt or anything else. Plus, you get more of this. Bix. If you want more of the Black Scorpion, support the show, man. Just support it.
And actually, to be completely honest, we actually get a bigger amount of money if you do the Kindle Unlimited trial for some reason.
So remember, fuck those guys.
Oh, no.
All right. Well,
that was the best Black Scorpion appearance in a while.
Oh, give me a break. They're all great.
And of course, also, if you want to check out Amazon Prime, that's tiny, and get the all and try that out too. And you can do the same thing, cancel right away, whatever. But free shipping on a number of things at Amazon stuff. Free two-day shipping, streaming videos, etc. That's tinyurl.com/605Prime. It's all pretty easy to follow once you figure out that it's tinyurl.com/605something. So.
Did someone say fuck those guys? Hello? Are there any midgets in the house?
Wonderful. All right. Okay. Just tinyurl.com/605Amazon. If you want to do the Kindle Unlimited thing and not give Kenny Bolin your money, it's tinyurl.com/605Kindle. And maybe that is the smarter way to go, considering what we've heard about giving Kenny Bolin money, credit cards, social security numbers.
It sounds like it's a level down from giving Santo Gold your credit card, so I'm not sure. But no, Kenny's a good guy, and actually we hope to have him on the show for Dentist of the Week pretty soon. And support the show. Please use the Amazon referral links.
And check out the book. And that's all in the show description too, of course.
Yep, 605pod.com. You'll see it in the description, and check it out. And please support us. We do appreciate it. But moving along, John McAdam, whose name just came up in the Tom Robinson thing, I believe. And we had part one of a conversation with him. We actually intended on playing the whole thing last week, but we thought it was going to run too long, and we thought it would be great to separate into two parts because it was such a fun conversation. First, I should mention that I don't know what Tom Robinson's problem is, but he wanted us specifically
I thought you had missed it, and I was going to try to.
He wanted us specifically not to mention the names Brian Trammell, Jamie Ward, or John McAdam this week, but they're such nice guys. I don't know why he wanted that. So I'm going to say their names right here. Brian Trammell, Jamie Ward, and John McAdam. Hello. And with that, this is part two of our discussion with John McAdam. Here's another guy you're going to be hearing a lot of in the weeks and months to come here on the show. And we specifically discuss here the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame. How do I put it, Bix? The Hall of Fame that I guess most people consider legitimate because there's actual voting by wrestlers and historians worldwide. Would you say so?
Pretty much.
Yeah, I mean, is there a Hall of Fame you could think of that has more credibility?
Not necessarily more. I mean, I would say that to some degree, I was going to say the one in Amsterdam, New York, but now it's not in Amsterdam, New York anymore. I think it has some kind of voting, but there is no voting system like the Observer Hall of Fame with as many wrestlers and as many journalists and historians and all that.
Yeah. And, you know, as many of you longtime listeners know, going back to the very beginning of this show, Bix and I have been debating various people for the Hall of Fame. We had a passionate debate a few weeks ago about Carlos Colon. And this is a topic that isn't going to go away. We're going to always come back to the Wrestling Observer Newsletter Hall of Fame. And this week we talk about it with John McAdam, who's as knowledgeable as they come. So here's that conversation with John McAdam. You know, I'm drawing a blank right now. Who did Bill Watts come back to work with when he was the Midnight Rider?
Butch Reed.
Was it Butch Reed?
I think so. And maybe some others, though. I'm pretty sure. Well, they also did the thing, though, where they would have the other Midnight Rider. No, actually, wait. Was Butch Reed maybe one of the Midnight? No, Butch Reed had turned face. Now I'm forgetting who it was. No, I was thinking about... No, what I was thinking about was... I think Butch Reed was one of the various other Midnight Riders when they teased that it would be Watts, and then they'd have one of the other baby faces under the mask.
Surprise! It's Butch Reed.
That's right.
That was pretty crazy.
Yeah, I think it may have been against Skandar Akbar, now that I think about it, his group of guys.
Yeah.
You know, John, one of the things Bix and I have talked about a lot on the show is the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame. It's become a little bit of an obsession of mine because, of course, I don't have a vote.
I'll try to change that as the season approaches.
See if you can do that, Bix. But as of right now, I don't have one, and I don't anticipate that changing unless Bix can work some of his Jewish magic on Dave Meltzer.
How did I know you were going to say Jewish magic?
Well, you know, because I didn't want to say black magic so you can make another Norman Smiley reference.
You wanted to say black magic so you could play your black magic sounds.
Yeah, I could do my black scorpion. That's right. Let's talk a little bit about the Hall of Fame, John. You know, one of the things that we've been talking about on the show is it is our belief that the Junkyard Dog is a Hall of Famer. What are your thoughts on the Junkyard Dog's candidacy for the Hall of Fame?
Okay, let me start by saying my thing when it comes to any Hall of Fame, you know, Observer Hall of Fame, Baseball Hall of Fame, et cetera, if there's an argument against you, if it's someone you really have to think about, if it's someone that really needs to be argued for, I vote against them. And I think Junkyard Dog is that next level down for what he did in Mid-South in his early WWF stuff. But I think a guy who had a peak of less than 5 years, and everything was downhill from there, I think he falls just short. JMO.
I think with him, he's a guy, perhaps more than any other, maybe the exception would be Sputnik Monroe, where you have to really consider the cultural context, though, of that here you have, deep in the South, a black guy being the hero, to the point that, yes, New Orleans, very big black population, but still, you know, even though that's his best city, to the point that he was such a big draw to the degree he was, I think adds to his candidacy, especially since his first big feud was feuding with guys who would dress up in Confederate flag stuff and all that in the Freebirds.
And don't get me wrong. I think JYD definitely has his strong points. I mean, he was a guy who they built a promotion around. And that promotion was around, you know, for the better part of a decade. And my question is that enough? You know, I mean, the Hall of Fame in any sport is supposed to be the highest honor, no honor higher.
You see, I guess, you know, one of the things I think about, I've been looking at it from the point of view of different Hall of Famers in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, for instance, have different runs. You know, Tiger Mask is in there for a 2-year run where you could argue he changed the game for junior heavyweight wrestlers, but it's a 2-year run. That's it. The Midnight Express, my favorite tag team of all time, they're in there for a 6-year run. They're in there for 1984 to 1990. And, you know, like the Baseball Hall of Fame, you have like Ralph Kiner, who's in there. He's in there for 10 years. And Sandy Koufax, obviously injury shortened his career, but he's in there for a short run. So I'm looking at it more that, you know, if you have a 5-year Hall of Fame run, that could be a qualifier. For me, it is. And that's one of the reasons I see JYD as a Hall of Famer, because from 1980 to 85, he is one of the biggest stars in professional wrestling. At the beginning of that, he's one of the biggest stars in professional wrestling working for what was at that time kind of a forgotten territory. I mean, Bill Watts was a big star, and they had some great guys in and out of there. But Mid-South wrestling, especially after he broke off from Leroy McGurk, was a tiny, tiny, tiny territory. And then when he got Leroy, And then he gets Leroy McGurk's territory, you know, when they make that deal. And then now he has Oklahoma and he has all those other cities. It greatly expands. But JYD popped that territory. He became the star of that territory. Of course, you have to look at that giant house in 1980 against Michael Hayes. He was, in many ways, an attraction that can go to other territories. He went to Georgia, where they recreated the Freebirds angle. He went to World Class several times. He went to Florida. He went to Mid-Atlantic. So, you know, he was getting so much publicity and fame in the wrestling magazines and from working from as tiny a territory as there really – I mean, look, Kansas City was a tiny territory. Kansas City was a town. St. Louis was a town. But he was working like a forgotten territory. It was, you know, for many wrestling fans, it was in the middle of nowhere. And he gets up to the World Wrestling Federation. And I think the argument could be made, and I would make it, that from the moment he got there until mid-85, until they changed his music, quite frankly, he may have been the second most popular babyface to Hogan. And they maybe should have given him the Intercontinental title at WrestleMania 1 against Greg Valentine. I don't know. You could argue that. But, you know, again, that's right there is a five-year run where he was – he may not have been a Hall of Fame worker, although I think his work – is how do I put this, Bix? Because I know you kind of agree with me. He's not as bad in the early days as people make him out to be in the later days. You know, the match against Flair in 1990 isn't indicative of a match against Nick Bockwinkel in 1983.
He had plenty of good matches. I mean, when that Stampede stuff was briefly on the network, we talked about it a little bit. He had a good match with that Patty Ryan guy. I mean, and this is when he was super green. Like, I think people who talk about how bad he was, they're just thinking of, you know, junk food dog in the WWF. They're not looking at the matches he had in Mid-South and in Houston and all that.
Well, a couple of trains of thought. Junkyard Dog was Mid-South's biggest star in the early 80s. I personally think he is 1980 Wrestler of the Year, at least in the United States.
Wow.
So I've got a high opinion of the guy.
Yeah. Wow.
At the same time, Mid-South also had the Freebirds. They had Ted DiBiase. They had Paul Orndorff. I mean, they had the Grappler, who was a lot better there than he was in other territories.
Yeah.
So, and you also had the best mind in wrestling behind it, Bill Watts. So, you know, like I said, I give him a lot of credit, but I'll also say he didn't do it all by himself. I have talked to people who were Mid-South fans. Who, you know, were in the area, and I've been told that by 83, Dog had really cooled off, and by 84, he was cold. And in some ways, you know, it was almost good that Vince McMahon stole JYD from Watts. It was time for him to go.
If I may ask, the people who told you that, were they from Oklahoma? Were they from New Orleans? What part of the territory were they in?
I specifically remember one gentleman who was from New Orleans proper.
Oh, that's interesting. Wow.
Yeah, and there's a story going around where the fans in Houston, this is in 83, gave Paul Bosch a petition saying, get this guy out of our main events.
What? I've never heard that one.
Maybe it's true. I heard it a long time ago. And again, you know, for all the listeners, I am not attempting to be disrespectful to the Junkyard Dog. I was a big fan of his. I was thrilled the first time I got to see him live in the Boston Garden as Sergeant Slaughter's surprise partner against Iron Sheik and Nikolai Volkoff. So, you know, I thought the North American title was every bit as prestigious a title as like the AWA or WWF title. So
wow.
He held that multiple times. Oh, yeah. I mean, so
I thought you were going to say the U.S. title. I was surprised that you went there. Wow.
I would say, you know what, probably a shade below the AWA, but definitely above the Crockett U.S. title. It was the lead title of Mid-South Wrestling, and they did not bring in the NWA champion, or at least they did not for a long time.
That's a good point.
You know, it was their top title, and JYD held it, you know, a few times.
You know, on a similar topic of this discussion we're having about JYD and the amount of time he was on top and what that time means, you know, another candidate Bix and I have talked about, same qualifications in many ways and in other ways different, Kerry Von Erich. What are your thoughts on his candidacy?
Very similar to Junkyard Dogs. I think he is that next step down, but he's just that one rung below a Hall of Famer. I mean, Kerry had a great career. Yeah, very similar to JYD in a lot of ways. Same time frame. He was obviously the top guy in his promotion and, you know, didn't do it by himself, but he did what he had to do.
So I guess part of my question is, and it's just, I'm going to throw this out there. It's one of the ones I have internally, is Tiger Mask is in for a 2-year period where he changed work rate. He brought a style. He brought a work rate to wrestling that affected every junior heavyweight that came after him.
And he wasn't even that good.
That could be argued. Kerry Von Erich and his brothers, for a few years there, were as hot as any act ever with a demographic that didn't traditionally come to wrestling. They brought more girls to wrestling than any other act or promotion this side of All Japan Women. And it stands out when you watch World Class from 83 or 84 or 85. The production's incredible, but it stands out that the audience is largely women, and they're vocal and they're expressive and Kerry Von Erich's the only wrestler I've ever seen make out with a girl on the way to the ring. And, you know, and I don't know if he, you know, could have avoided it, you know, because they were all just running around trying to kiss him. And, you know, I understand the run of the Von Erichs are like the potential, but it didn't work out for the whole family. For Kevin, David, and Kerry.
Yeah.
But I look at it and I wonder if what exactly they did and how they popped their crowd, you know, with the Freebird feud and how they changed the crowds coming to wrestling, if that needs to be appreciated more than it is.
They, in a lot of ways, World Class Wrestling and the Von Erichs revolutionized pro wrestling because it went from, I mean, in the WWF, Tony Garea was the good-looking guy. He was the pretty baby face, okay? It's true!
I know.
And then then the girls got Rick Martel. But, you know, for years, it was Tony Garea. And now you're looking at, you know, guys like Kerry Von Erich and you know, Kevin was a good-looking guy. I remember back in the 80s, me and my friends were watching wrestling and our girlfriends were there. And I'm like, why are they not complaining that wrestling's on? Oh, I don't know, because Kerry Von Erich's wrestling Gino Hernandez. they revolutionized everything. After the Von Erichs caught fire, now you're seeing promotions pushing the good-looking guys. The Magnum, you know, Crockett had Magnum TA, Ricky Steamboat. The WWF was going for, you know, some of the younger athletic bodybuilder guys. So, and a lot of that goes back to the Von Erichs. I definitely give them credit for that. On the other hand, and this is my take on Hall of Fames in general. Every Hall of Fame has a mistake or two in there. I think Sayama was a mistake.
Wow. And Bill Mazeroski.
Yeah, I do. Well, I'm with you. You know, 2 years does not a Hall of Fame career make. You know, and to me, you just can't compare a candidate to the guys that are on the bottom of the list. They need to be compared to the guys in the middle of the list, the guys right around that 45 to 55 percentile of Hall of Famers. And I think if you do that, JYD and Kerry fall a little bit short.
Now, for those listening, by the way, who don't believe what he's saying about Tony Garea, watch some Tony Garea matches from the Spectrum and listen to Cal Rudman. And listen to Cal Rudman and Dick Graham just gush about his handsome features and what a great profile he has.
However, Bix, with all due respect, Cal Rudman gushed that way about various wrestlers. I mean, there's that one interview
where
he practically wants to jump on Don Morocco.
Not on commentary as much, though. More during the promos where it seemed like he wanted to have his way with Don Morocco or Barry Windham or Hulk Hogan.
Or maybe have Don Morocco have his way with him. I mean, we really don't know.
you know, what promo I have on YouTube, I mean, where he's like, you can tell that Morocco's clearly aware of it. where he like takes his sunglasses off and he's like biting on the earpiece. He's just such a tease with the Cal Run.
I gotta say, before we get back to this Hall of Fame discussion, I think 1982, 83, but mostly 83, Don Morocco may be the coolest wrestler of all time. He's definitely high on my list for someone who I just watch it. God damn, he's so cool.
Yeah, and he was in the WWF in 1981. That's exactly how he came off, just like this cool guy from Hawaii who, you know, has all the athletic talent in the world. He's cocky and arrogant. Yeah, you got to love him, you know?
Now, so, do you still consider Cal Rudman interviewing the Moondogs the most embarrassing segment in wrestling history, by the way?
No, this is going – I am about to partake in the most embarrassing segment in pro wrestling history. And not to get too personal, I am straight, and it never occurred to me that Cal Rudman might be gay until you guys just started talking about that.
No.
Yeah,
he's actually married. I know for a fact he's married.
It's just if you watch those interviews he does on
that
the Spectrum
means everything.
Shows.
Yeah, Oscar Wilde was married.
I would be the worst gay guy ever because I have no gaydar. I cannot figure out who is what unless it's explained to me. So I never even saw Cal Rudman in that light.
Well, you know, to get back to this Hall of Fame discussion before we get more perverted on here.
We're not on the air, but go ahead.
No, we are. We are. A couple more names I want to ask you your opinion on. Another one who I believe is a Hall of Famer. I don't remember, Bix, if you said you did or didn't, but Ole Anderson. What do you think, John?
We had about 12 or 13 years ago on Wrestling Classics, we had like a 30-page debate on whether or not Ole Anderson belonged in the Hall of Fame. And I was like, no, he falls short. You know, he wasn't really a main eventer. Despite the fact that he had been in main events. Okay, so Chief J. Strongbow. But I have actually changed my mind because my take on it is that over the last 12 or 13 years, many tag teams have been put in the Observer Hall of Fame, and compared to those other tag teams, that 45 to 55%, the Andersons definitely belong in. Ole and Gene belong in my opinion. So that's all. That's Ole.
Well, that's interesting because, you know, I've kind of been saying that I think Ole belongs in, but maybe that's what's hurt his the voting firm is that he was aligned with Gene in the on the ballot as opposed to just being Ole Anderson, who you look at as a wrestler, but then you also get to look at him as a booker. And, you know, some of the booking may not be Hall of Fame caliber, but certainly for a while it was. And, you know, a promoter as well. So I thought that maybe the candidacy would be stronger just being Ole Anderson as opposed to the Anderson brothers tag team.
Well, he's not a Hall of Fame promoter.
No.
Maybe a booker, but not a
promoter.
Yeah.
That's absolutely true.
There's so many negatives with Ole as a booker that I could not even consider that a positive in his candidacy.
Speaking of bookers and promoters and wrestlers, one of the ones that's not in the Hall of Fame that bothers me just because I feel – and again, I said this on the show recently. No disrespect to Paul Heyman, at least for this. But Paul Heyman's in the Hall of Fame as a booker, not as a manager, because his amazing run the last few years happened after he was already elected to the Hall of Fame. But Jerry Jarrett's not in the Hall of Fame. What are your thoughts on Jerry Jarrett's candidacy?
I think Jerry Jarrett is a solid candidate. I wouldn't fight for his candidacy, but I could definitely see him being inducted. You know, the problem with that is, for one, I look at a candidate at their entire body of work, not just as a booker, as a wrestler, their entire body of work. That's just the way the business goes. And Paulie, I think him as a manager plus as owner of ECW, I see him as a valid candidate. The problem is once you let Jerry Jarrett in, does Jim Crockett Jr. go in? Jim Crockett Sr., Paul Bosch, I think, is already in. Don Owen, you know, where does that line get crossed? It's a tough one.
Well, I guess because Jerry Jarrett was an owner, but he was also a booker. So it's more in line with an Eddie Graham or a Bill Watts who weren't. Jim Crockett Jr. wasn't a booker. Jim Crockett Jr. owned the company. and owned the company that did the promoting, but he didn't actually sit down with a pen and paper and write the TVs. So I feel like there are different calibers of owners and bookers out there.
I agree with that. The other side of the coin is just using Eddie Graham as an example. I mean, he might have had a Hall of Fame career just as a wrestler. And then when you throw in owner of Florida Championship Wrestling, I mean, to me, he's a slam dunk.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, again, Bill Watts and Jerry Jarrett are very similar in that they both went to train under Eddie Graham. And they both went back and owned and booked their own territories and at times had other bookers, but they kind of oversaw them, especially Watts. Watts was notorious for, you know, looking over the shoulder of his bookers. But yeah, I just feel like Jerry Jarrett is a major exclusion so far from this Hall of Fame, just because he had a successful territory for years and years and years. Many of the years he was the only person who made any money, him and Lawler, but they ran and they were wildly successful. And even before he had his own company, he was a successful booker for the western end of the Nick Gulas territory. And he opened
up. That's right.
Yeah, and he opened up Louisville. I mean, that wasn't an active wrestling market. He went there. He started virtually from scratch. It had been dormant. And he built up Louisville. I mean, he built it up from nothing. So now, you know,
When did the Bruiser pull out of Louisville?
5 years before, I think, about. Does that sound right?
Okay, that's pretty dormant.
Yeah.
I think it's something like that. Yeah, about 5 years. And also, I do wonder with Jarrett, to a degree, like how much of it is anti-Tennessee wrestling bias. Like with you, I know it's not. But there are still, I could say, I used to think it was more people in the business. Now you start to see more fans who have the anti-Tennessee bias. But I mean, I'm sure some of it's for good reasons. They didn't pay well, blah, blah, blah. But some of it's just, oh, that hokey Tennessee shit type of attitude.
The Ole Anderson attitude, basically what you're saying.
Well, it wasn't just Ole, but yeah.
No, I know.
And you also have to consider, you know, who is on that voting panel and who does that, you know, the Observer Hall of Fame, and who had the ear of that panel. You know, Lou Fez was very much an anti-Tennessee wrestling kind of guy. And I know, you know, a lot of people on there knew Lou.
Yet he was a inaugural member of the Eddie Gilbert fan club. Well, that's true.
Wow, we're going way back with Eddie. Yeah.
The TNT fan club run by Terry Justice had Jim Cornette as a fan club member, had Lou Thez as a fan club member. Forgetting some other notable
wrestlers. Ilio Zarlinga from the Toronto, who went on to work for the Toronto office.
Yeah, but that was even before he was a wrestler.
Brian Hildebrand
was, yeah.
I'm forgetting someone else who was an older. Was Danny Hodge a member?
What were you going to say, John?
Here's just a crazy story about me meeting a wrestler. I was at the Brian Pillman, one of his fundraiser shows, and I saw someone in the wrestling business that was there, and I remember seeing his name as part of a fan club thing. And I just went up to him and bullshitted him. I'm like, hey, you probably don't remember me, but you and I used to correspond when, you know, back when we were in the fan club days. And Tom Pritchard's like, what's your name? I'm like, I'm John McAdam. He goes, oh, I remember you. So we're sitting there lying to each other, but making friends.
He may be one of the people we could ask about the petition coming into Paul Bosch about the JYD. Either him or his brother may know.
I think, yeah, maybe. I know Tom was already actively wrestling by 83. Yeah. But, Scott Williams might be a good guy to ask about that. But it's definitely a story that I heard.
To go back a little bit to tape trading, John, I'm just wondering if you remember off the top of your head, because it, you know, it has been a while, who were the best people to trade tapes with and who were the worst people to trade tapes with?
I was the best. Oh man. One of the best people to trade with, I'm trying desperately to remember his name, but he was a really, really good guy, and he sent me my Smoky Mountain Wrestling religiously every 4 weeks. The tape would have 4 episodes on it, and he would send it out on Monday, and I would put it in the VCR on like Thursday, and I would swear up and down that I'll watch one episode today, one episode tomorrow. I won't binge watch, and of course, that's all I spent my night doing was watching 4 hours of Smoky Mountain. I'm trying to think of various names. Meltzer was always good. Jeff Bowdrin was always really good. Boy, you're right. It has been a long time. Richard Vajcic. Oh. The guy who's writing the Dick the Bruiser book.
Yeah,
was one of the first people
that
I traded tapes with. And he was great.
Huh. Wow.
You know what? Get in touch with him if you can. He has some crazy-ass Chicago amphitheater stories.
Yeah, well, we're going to be doing a feature on the show about the Dick the Bruiser book, and I'm going to reach out to Scott Teal, and I'm going to see what he could do for that, because Scott's a good friend of our show, and he has gone out of his way to try to get us in touch with different authors of his book. So, you know what? I am going to definitely work on that for the show. Let me ask you this. What was Meltzer like as a tape trader? Was he always on time with his tapes? How was his quality? You know, what did you think of his stuff?
Meltzer was very big on – he doesn't care about nostalgia. He doesn't care about, like, big-name matches. He just wants, like, the 4 or 5-star matches, and that's the stuff that you would get from him. His quality, I wasn't going to say it was always impeccable. I'm not saying this in a bad way. You just have to go back to it was a different era where if you could find, like, a good tape from, like, 1981 where no one had a VCR – and the VCR itself was the antenna, so if it's cloudy outside or whatever, you're not getting good reception. You know, that's just the way it was back then. And, yeah, but, you know, Dave was great. Jeff was great. I can't think of any other, like, Jamie Ward was great.
Ah, our friend.
But, yeah, you know, it's been so long. I apologize. I can't give you, more better examples.
No, that's all right. I mean, like, I'm thinking about some of the things that would have been circulating in the 80s that – you know, we're hard to find. At least when I started trading in the 90s, it was hard to find. And when you could find it, it was hard to find good quality of. But like, when was the first time you got to see Slaughter against Patterson or Slaughter against the Iron Sheik, those bloody matches from the Garden?
Oh, definitely 87. One of the first people, actually someone right after I got the Observer for the first time, someone else wrote back to me, and he had a big tape list, and he mostly had Madison Square Garden and Philly stuff. And I'm not sure how this guy was selling tapes, $25 each, but 5 for $100. Now, Dave, I don't know if you have that inflation calculator handy, but I actually sent this guy $100 for MSG shows, but I don't think that was any of them. But one of them was the Bob Backlund Iron Sheik match, which was incredible.
That's an interesting show to watch because the way the lighting and stuff is different. Like, it's not really a good show, but it's kind of like it stands out because it seems like they're trying to do something with that show, with the different lighting and stuff.
Is that the first one where they switch the camera from the one side to the other?
I'm not sure, but it's a different lighting from every other MSG show.
Yeah.
You guys have such an attention to detail. It's great. It's one of the great things about the podcast, that you guys want the details and that you pick up on stuff like that.
Anybody can just do an overview. we want to make sure that, you know, any of these stories are preserved with the actual facts, you know, every small one of them.
Oh, here's a question for you as a New Englander. Did you ever go to any of the Savoldi shows?
Yes, as a matter of fact.
Here we go.
I went to a couple. I went to one in 85 at the Billerica, Massachusetts Ice Arena. And Dr. D, David Schultz, fresh off his WWF firing, was there. And it was a TV taping. And Schultz had everyone in the crowd so scared shitless in a bad way. Like, you were afraid to say something because you thought this guy was going to jump out of the ring and kick your ass. Then I went to another one in 86, another TV taping, and he had advertised just some crazy names like Austin Idol, a bunch of them, and they were all no-shows. And you just sat there and wondered, like, okay, you know, how badly was I set up on this one? But, you know, if you want to talk about arenas in New England, when I first moved here in 1975, we first moved to a town called North Attleboro, Massachusetts, which is well known because they had WWF wrestling every Friday night at Jack Witchie Sports Arena, which was about a little over a mile from where I lived.
Right. And I believe Kevin Sullivan says that North Attleboro was the best drawing per capita wrestling town in the United States during that period.
Had to be, because it was, I believe when I lived there, there were like 6,000 people in the town.
And how would the shows draw?
That's a good question, because back then you could not get any straight information. I believe they generally drew about 500 or 600 people per show. And that's what I've heard. I'm not sure how accurate that is. I'm not sure if there is any accurate information out there. I went a total of 3 times, and the place didn't seem filled out, but it seemed pretty full, if that makes sense.
Yeah. With Savoldi and that taping you mentioned going to in 85, which I think you were saying it sounded like David Schultz's first taping with them after, or only, knowing how Savoldi worked, after getting fired by the WWF. Do you recall if that's also the taping where Bob Backlund brought out his cardboard belt?
That was not the taping, unfortunately. Backlund was not on this show.
Aww.
I believe that taping was in Lewiston, Maine. I could be wrong.
That actually sounds right. Do you remember seeing that on TV, though, the cardboard belt?
I definitely did. Bob, I have grown to like Bob Backlund and appreciate him more over the years. But during that time, I absolutely hated Bob Backlund. And, well, you know, Bob just giving me another reason to hate him even more. I mean, when you're that age, you're consumed with being cool and like seeing cool guys, and Bob Backlund was the antithesis of cool.
Well, were you always a heel fan, and if not, when did you turn on Bob?
Was I always a heel fan? No. At first, I was strictly a babyface fan. And then when you saw the wrestlers, the heels who had more charisma, I liked them. I liked Ken Patera. I liked Greg Valentine. But I also liked a bunch of the baby faces. I mean, I loved Strongbow. If it wasn't for Strongbow, I wouldn't be standing here talking to you right now. I loved Bobo Brazil, Bruno Sammartino. It just depended on the wrestler as opposed to the dressing room that the wrestler came out of.
What was Superstar Graham like when you first saw him? What are you thinking the first time you see him?
Aptly nicknamed. I mean, this guy was oozing charisma. No one had a body like that. His interviews are now a little bit overrated because he was more [S2] Yes. [S1] Of an 8 than a 10. But, you know, I mean, just the guy was supremely charismatic and probably wasn't as bad in the ring as the internet wrestling community makes him out to be, at least during the 70s.
I would agree with that. I mean, from like if you watch especially those AWA films, he's mm-hmm. he's bumping big and stuff. I think our perceptions of him are more the same thing that happened to everyone that went to the WWF, that all of a sudden they started, you know, wrestling like they were in cement boots.
Sure. I mean, sometimes wrestling fans talk about, you know, alternate universes. Like, okay, if the WWF didn't bring in Hulk Hogan, well, who should they have brought in? I mean, Hogan was the number one choice by a million miles. I feel that way about superstar Billy Graham being the one who came in to replace Sammartino. Some people might say, oh, maybe Patera, maybe Koloff. To me, it's not even a discussion. Superstar Billy Graham was the choice.
You know, on that topic, I saw you write something recently on a group that we're all part of. What did you think Greg Valentine meant to the WWF during his early runs? And specifically, you wrote something about where you thought he was going. Can you explain that?
Yes. You mean like in 1981?
Yes.
Okay. Someone who worked for the WWF in 1981 and I had a conversation, I want to say, in 1988. And this person – I'm sorry?
Oh, no one said anything.
I'll keep going.
Yeah,
we had a conversation in 1988. He worked for the WWF, had worked for them for a long time. He told me that there was a plan in place where Greg Valentine would win the WWF title October 1981 in Madison Square Garden, and they were going to bring in David Sammartino and groom him for the top spot and give him the top spot. And I don't know. I kind of don't think it's true at this point, because Greg Valentine has done enough shoot interviews where this would have come out. So I'm just saying this is what I was told. And for whatever reason, they changed their mind. He thought it was because the NWA made Ric Flair champion and Flair was too much like Valentine.
Huh. Interesting.
Something that has nothing to do with this that I want to ask you about, but I saw you post about a while back, and I'm curious to hear more about this, because I don't know if it was really reported, at least, I mean, it might have been hinted at, but I don't know if it was outright reported in the newsletters at the time, that around 1990, the WWF had some kind of mole in the WCW office. And that whenever WCW made overtures towards someone, I remember Pat Tanaka being the example, WWF would just sign them just to sign them. Like, what do you know about all of this? And why do you think it hasn't been repeated more over the years? Because that was the first I had ever heard of it.
I mean, this was back in the day where, like, you know, probably not a day went by where I didn't have a phone call like the one that we're having now, you know, from someone who knew someone in the industry or just a super fan or a combination of both. And yeah, I had been told that story specifically, that Tanaka had a WCW contract in front of him, and that's when the WWF said, okay, now we'll sign you. I'm trying to think of who else this happened with. I probably shouldn't mention names, but supposedly that this went on with Tom Pritchard, that he got with the WWF and said, yes, I have a WCW contract in front of me. And he really didn't, and he couldn't prove it. So that went down the toilet. but yeah, I'm trying to think of any other examples, and I can't right now, but I definitely heard that about Tanaka. I think Steve Beverly might have printed that, but I don't quote me on that. But I think that's where that might have come from.
I think recently me and Zellner were doing like that week on Between the Sheets, and there was something that hinted at it, but I don't think he outright said it.
One thing, you know, I used to run around with Meltzer, and one thing that I knew, that not everything that he knew or not the complete story was always in the Observer. Read into that what you will.
I mean, we all know with the Observer, you always have to know to read between the lines of what Dave is writing, and you have to learn how to understand what Dave is saying when he has to write the Observer that kind of way.
Yeah, and it's a lot easier to read between the lines when he got rid of that typewriter with the flying O's.
that thing belongs in the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame.
Yeah, really. I wonder if he still has that typewriter somewhere. He must.
I guarantee you he does.
That's got to be in the next WWE themed restaurant, Dave's old typewriter with the flying O.
Well, listen.
Those were the cool days of getting the Observer, though, because it looked like you were getting something that you were not supposed to have, something that really was underground, CIA-looking. Fun times.
What Dave should have done when the typewriter broke was put it together with type from different magazines, like a ransom note.
He could have come out with one issue like that. It would have been great. Just one page in one issue.
Hey, one last thing about the newsletters. You mentioned Steve Beverly. Were you getting Matt Watch, and what did you think of it?
I was getting Matt Watch. I thought it was outstanding. And one thing that Steve did – I talked earlier about if you get the Observer, you get everything. Steve came from a unique point of view where he came from a television point of view. And Steve was very smart, and Steve, I think he not only understood the business, but he could see where the business was going, and he could see how it could be better. And you know, Jim Cornette will break my face with his tennis racket if I said this in front of him, but Steve had an excellent idea called bring in writers. No, I don't think that two guys in the back of a car are going to come up with better ideas than a professional writer who has done something elsewhere. Sorry. And that was Steve's idea. And I'm not saying hand the whole thing to him, but make this, you know, get a few of these people, make them part of a booking committee, and don't treat them like stepchildren who don't belong there. I felt in 1990 that was going to be the future of the business, and for once I was right.
Yeah, I remember he did it. It was an issue entirely about different ideas to save WCW. Because we were getting to that point in WCW where it was like, no one will ever be able to turn this company around. And he had made a bunch of suggestions. One of them was that they hire, like, it was like a specific soap opera writer, too. It wasn't just hire a TV writer. It was,
yes.
I forget the name, but it was like a specific soap opera writer who was like the best in the business at the time. And he was like, have him come in. And I think it's more like, it doesn't even necessarily just need to be breaking story ideas as much as structure. Like, I don't know if it's what WWE's going for or if they feel like they need to because they're corporate and publicly traded or whatever. The only time they really ever had that was with Chris Kresge in 2000, where even though you wouldn't think of it from his background, which I'm trying to remember, he was like, what was it? Like, he was on Beavis and Butthead for a little while, maybe? Or where was it? I don't remember his exact background. But he brought a lot of structure and continuity to everything. And that was his big strength. He would storyboard stuff, and I think people even make fun of it. But that is by far the most cohesive part of that era in 2000 when he was booking. I mean, and they always did little things like they always stuck with. Like, I remember after Shane McMahon and Test had their match, and Shane is like, okay, we're cool. You beat me. I give you my blessing to marry my sister. That sure worked out well. They always had it that those two were friends, whether they were heels, whether they were baby faces, whether one was a heel and the other was a baby face. They were always aligned. They wouldn't always be together. But if Shane needed help in a match, all of a sudden Test runs out. It's like, oh, right, these two are friends. And that's the type of thing that they don't really have, and that wrestling didn't always have. Some promotions did. You know, Memphis was good about remembering history, and maybe to a point Continental and Southeastern were, but not everyone, for sure. And that was what was missing. Someone who could do like a show Bible for wrestling to keep Watts, track of everyone in their history.
Watts was very good at that.
Oh, absolutely.
Watts was the best at it.
Yes.
Watts and Graham. And, you know, there are some people who will tell you, to me, it's funny when wrestlers do it. It's even funnier when non-wrestlers do it. They will say with a completely straight face, no, he's never been in the ring, so he can offer you nothing, which is garbage.
Like Sam Mushnick.
Oh, like Vince McMahon.
Exactly. Well, originally.
Yeah.
I mean, I would have indie guys telling me, oh, you don't know anything about wrestling. You have to be in the ring to do it. Who has ever been successful? This is like 92. I'd look at them and say, what about Vince McMahon? And it's like, oh, gee, like they've never thought of that before. That's how brainwashed they are. And, oh, he's the one exception. I was like, well, I'm going to be exception number two. I was wrong. But you know what? I mean, you have to – I'm sorry. I'm not on the right page here. But if you're an indie promoter – and I told Gabe Sapolsky this one day. I'm like, Gabe, don't listen to their big league bullshit because they don't know what they're talking about. And some of the worst wrestling I've ever seen was WCW, I want to say 93, 94, when they had a booking committee with Greg Gagne, Robert Fuller, Bill Dundee, and whoever else I'm forgetting about. And they didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah.
Sorry, that was a tangent. Save the show, guys.
I didn't know where to go from there, but we're going to wrap this up right now because I know Bix and me have to take care of some stuff. But this was a lot of fun, John. We should definitely do this again.
We should definitely do this again, and you guys beat me to it because I have to get out of here. But this was a real pleasure. It is weird for me because I listen to you guys' show, and all of a sudden now it's like I'm having this weird dream that I'm on the show. So thank you.
Well, that was a lot of fun, and like we said there, we definitely anticipate having John McAdam on the show again in the future. We had a lot of fun talking with him, and he's very knowledgeable, and he has great stories and great inside thoughts about a lot of this stuff. But Bix, what was it cool? Was it cool for you having John on the show the last couple weeks?
Yeah, and yeah, like I talked about before, it's just so weird. People that I've known for so long that I never talked to on the phone before. It's just a weird vibe. But it was a lot of fun to talk to him. I mean, he's got tons of stories and been to, like, so many different shows, and was in that whole group of I guess, what would you call it? Not just the early Smart fans, but also like your UAWF convention. You get where I'm going with this, right?
Yeah, I mean, we had for those of you who didn't see it, and we'll probably this week put it in the video playlist again. But last week in the video playlist, we had footage from the UAWF convention in Memphis in 1988, which is awesome because, like, you get to see Dennis with Nate Durratt. You get to see John McAdam. You get to see Paulie Dangerously mixing around with everyone. Robinson. Russell. Lance Russell, who is just hysterical because at the very beginning, they ask him about the Nate Durratt fan club. And just, like, off the cuff, he gives this whole speech about how it's going to be the biggest thing since the Wrestling Observer Newsletter. And it's hysterical. Dave Meltzer. If you've ever wanted to see Dave Meltzer in suspenders running around, this is the video for you. Missy Hyatt, Eddie Gilbert, who's who of people are in this video. And we also put up the actual banquet from that year where various people like Dave Meltzer and Lance Russell, Lou Thesz, everyone spoke, Boyd Pierce. So we'll put both of those again. For those of you who didn't see it last week, we will put them again in the video playlist this week.
You know what? With the suspenders, you know who Dave looked like then? PBT is.
Oh, I was going to say Mork from Ork.
Six of one, half dozen of the other.
Yeah, with that hairdo and LP Bay Diaz. Yeah, I guess so. A little bit. He was a lot more buff than LP Bay Diaz.
That's true.
How many people got the Observer and corresponded with Dave, and then they met him and they're like, holy shit, this guy's a bodybuilder. You wouldn't expect that. And he was jacked back then. So it's funny. And again, in the middle of this whole thing with Dennis Carluzzo and Tom Robinson and Nate Durratt and Paulie Dangerously, all of a sudden someone comes and pulls Paulie aside and it's Dave Meltzer. Just, comes and interrupts everything and pulls Paulie away. So it's pretty funny to see. Well, we'll definitely have that again this week so you can check it out.
Oh, by the way.
Yeah.
Just a completely random thing before we move on. So I recorded with Joe Gagne and Rob Naylor an episode of Joe versus the World, kind of revisiting the Global Wrestling Federation podcast we did 9 years ago for the 10th anniversary of Joe's podcast. And okay. I was looking through my Matt Watch collection for early global stuff, like pre-global with the investors and the international banks and all that. And so then I collected all these articles, and then in the week that they launch, so you've got two things, which is the headline of Matt Watch, which is Ready or Not, Pedicino's in the Wrestling Business. And then there is a guest column in Matt Watch called Is Joe Pedicino the Savior of U.S. Wrestling by Dr. Mike Lano.
Did it have quotes from people that he definitely didn't speak to?
I don't see any quotes, no.
That was the one thing I noticed when I was going through the acknowledgments and the liner notes in that new Bruiser book by Richard Vysick and edited by Scott Teal, was it had like all these like historians, like Fred Hornby and all these different people. And then it said, Bruno Sammartino was interviewed by Dr. Mike Lano. And I'm like, uh-oh, I'm not sure if that interview took place or if it did. I'm not sure if Bruno said any of those things. But we're more with Dr. Mike Lano pretty soon. I know I'm shocked how many people have asked us to have stories about Dr. Mike Lano, because I feel like it's like one of these like inside baseball kind of things where, Smart fans and newsletter readers and people used to travel to shows know all about the legend of Dr. Mike Lano. And then like just regular everyday people be like, can you talk about the crazy dentist, Dr. Mike Lano? And we will, when we have John Arezzi on. He tells maybe the mother of all crazy Dr. Mike Lano stories. So stay tuned for that. That's coming up. It's already in the can. We just got to roll it out. But it's coming up pretty soon.
Yeah, those are the be-all and end-all of Dr. Mike Lano stories. Like,
the greatest. And I've never heard either one of those before. So, incredible. Incredible.
All before he was a dentist.
Yes, when he was just fanboy oddity, as it was put. Mike Lano. But speaking of stuff that we've recorded, it's now time for Bobby Simmons part 3. Part 1 and 2 have gotten just great reaction from everyone. I thought part 2 was incredible, just the whole dynamic of everything with Ole and Barnett. And this time for part 3, we specifically go over various wrestlers and bookers who worked for Georgia Championship Wrestling during the years where Bobby was there. The Mr. Wrestling 2s, the Rocket Monroe, the Dr. Jerry Graham, and various other people. And we had a lot of really funny stories and a lot of good insight. And you'll also hear just how big Mr. Wrestling 2 was for Georgia Championship Wrestling. So with that, here is part three of our conversation with Bobby Simmons, former referee and office manager for Georgia Championship Wrestling. You know, you mentioned earlier that when you began to work for Georgia Championship Wrestling, Fred Ward did not want you working his shows. How did that coldness begin to thaw?
Supply and demand. There was a Thursday afternoon. The guy that was supposed to referee making TV calls, he's broke down and he can't make TV. They didn't have a referee for TV. I was sitting in the office. And Harley says, well, there's nobody here but Bobby. Send him, we'll use him. So that's what broke the ice. They didn't have anybody, so all of a sudden I was better than nothing, I guess. And I went down there and refereed their TV. And from then on, I never had another issue. I refereed all their towns from then on.
You know, I want to ask you about some of the talent that you've worked with through the years. And please share with us any memories you have of working with them or just any funny stories that come up. But, you know, I know you worked with at least two different Graham brothers. You worked with Dr. Jerry Graham and Crazy Luke Graham. What are your memories of them?
The thing I remember most about Dr. Jerry Graham was his charisma. Here was a guy that he walked into a building, he had to open his mouth and he got heat with people. I mean, the fans hated him, man. All he had to do was walk in. And the guy had such tremendous talent and such a great knowledge of the wrestling business. Of course, you know, he had gotten so big he couldn't do a lot anymore, but he just, he had it. Whatever it is, he had it. And not everybody did, but he was just, he was phenomenal with the way people just hated this guy. And he was, even the guys in the business didn't like him too well. He was notorious for, he was notorious for getting drunk and doing crazy things. And he would, you know, you had to be careful with him if he rode with you, because he would get drunk and he would urinate in your car, or he would throw up, or he was just, it was really sad more than anything. But I'll give you one little story. We were, Carlos Colon was working for Ann. Carlos Colon was coming into Atlanta and working some. And we were sending, Ann was sending some talent down to him to work for his shows in Puerto Rico. And they had sent the good doctor down there. And he worked town one night, and he was staying at the El San Juan Hotel. And they had a swimming pool in the middle of the lobby. It was inside the building. And they said he came in one night and he'd been drinking a little bit or a whole lot. He jumped in the pool with all his clothes on and stripped down naked and floated around the pool naked in the hotel with a six-pack sitting on his chest. And so that was one of his – they finally – Bill Bowman, who recently passed away, dear friend, they called Bill because Bill had managed them for a long time on the Gulf Coast. Bill went over and talked him out of the pool, and he got out and picked his suitcase up and walked up the steps butt naked. And they said all that was left was his clothes floating in the pool. So that's a good Dr. Jerry story.
What Luke about Graham Crazy was, Luke? Yeah.
Luke was, you know, he's from Georgia. He got his big break and he became a Graham brother and he made a lot of money up in New York. And, I worked with Luke many, many times here. Super nice guy. There again, Luke was known to take a drink, but Luke was never crazy. Matter of fact, he was one of the people that I kind of wanted him to have a drink before we went in the ring because it mellowed him out. But he was another funny guy. Another funny guy. Give you a story on him. We were working in a National Guard armory somewhere. I don't even remember where we were. And he was working with Ray Candy and spotted a guy on the back row, probably 10, 15 rows back, huge guy, probably weighed about 400 pounds sitting back there, and he was screaming, yelling. And I put a bug in Luke's ear. I said, keep an eye on that guy. I said, I don't know what he's doing, but he's kind of acting, you know, a little crazy. So Luke goes over to the ropes and goes into the crazy bit with a guy. So we go back into the batch, and we're working along, and I look out, and the guy's moved up. He's on about the fourth row now. So I told Luke, I said, the guy's on the fourth row now. I said, keep an eye on him. Work along. Finally, the guy's sitting on the front row. And I told Luke, I said, he's on the front row. So Luke loaded up his gimmick in his thumb, and he hit Candy with the thumb. Candy went down, face down, and Luke goes over to the ropes, sits down on the middle rope, pushes the top rope up, doing the crazy bit, and motions for the guy to come in the ring. So I walked over, and I tapped him on the shoulder, and I said, excuse me. I said, this is really none of my business right now. I said, but it could become my business shortly. I said, what are we going to do if that big guy comes in here? And he turns around, he looks at me, and he goes, let's make sure we don't have a double knockout as we go out the other side. And I said, okay. But the guy never came in, so.
What about someone you mentioned earlier was the Missouri Mauler, Larry Hamilton.
Only guy in the wrestling business I was afraid of. I mean, literally scared. I was literally scared of. I never had what I had hair over my knee, over my ears, but it never was, you know, I never could put it in a ponytail or let it grow down my back. I just wore it over my ears. But Larry was, he hated hippies. He hated anybody that was a nonconformist. He was redneck. You know, you look up in the dictionary, that was Larry. And when I first broke in, you know, and he's here and out here and talking to investment, I'd just get over in the corner and cower. I'd just sit there. I wouldn't say nothing. And excuse me, first time I was ever in a ring with him, we were in a spot show, and he was wrestling a guy named Charlie Cook. And it's a 2 out of 3 fall match. The first fall, he is supposed to get disqualified for hitting me. So I was literally so afraid of him. When we got ready to do the deal, he threw the punch at me, and he got about 3 or 4 or 5 inches from me. I mean, he was literally, let's say, 6 inches from touching me. I flew across the ring, took this big, huge bump. I thought, God, you idiot. I peeked out of my eye, and I looked up at him, and he was standing in the corner looking at his fist and looking at me. So I disqualified him. We go to the dressing rooms between falls. He's laughing when I went in there. I was scared to go back there. When I get back there, he's laughing. He goes, Bobby, he said, at least let me touch you. I said, yes, sir, I'm sorry. So we go back out, and I'm thinking, well, I've survived that. I felt better. He's not that bad a guy. He laughed about it. I'm going to be okay. Charlie Cook bailed him from one corner to the other, and the rope broke. Not the rope, but the ring broke. The welding on the pole came off, and it just sat out on the floor on that side. And me and Charlie Cook slipped because the ring went to such an angle, and we slid down, and we're on top of him, and we're kicking him trying to get up. He was cussing. Me and Charlie Cook were laughing, and we couldn't get off of him. And, you know, that was my initial encounter with Larry Hamilton. But Larry was never anything other than nice to me. He was a remarkable wrestler. He was a good guy. And when he got out of the business, he went home to St. Joe, Missouri, and became a bail bondsman. And I, for the life of me, cannot think of any reason in the world why you would jump a bail when you knew he would be coming after you.
Well, you know, another wrestler I want to ask you about who I believe you worked with is someone who fortunately there is at least a little bit of footage of out there. A very unique individual, and that's Moondog Mayne.
Unique. That's a good word for that. I had the privilege of meeting Shane, his brother, a few years ago, and me and Shane have become good friends. We stay in contact. I get to see him at Cauliflower Alley every year. But Lonnie was unique. He was different. You never knew what he was going to do. He was a great jokester. First thing he did to me, we were coming out of Albany one night, and I was by myself, and I mean, it was country roads. It was dark. You know, you're out in the middle of nowhere. I had the radio wide open. I had the window down. I'm trying to stay awake. And all of a sudden, I feel something pushing me. And I look in my rearview mirror, and I can see absolutely nothing. There's nothing back there. But I'm being pushed. All of a sudden, the bright lights come on. He comes around me in his van. And I don't remember who was riding with him, but whoever was with him had his butt hung out the window. And he had run. I don't know how fast he ran and how far he ran with his lights off to catch up to me, to do that to me. I mean, insanity. He could have hit a deer. He could have hit anybody. But he chose to hit me. But that was the first thing he did to me. Second thing he did, we were at a spot show somewhere, and he had these combination locks on these high school lockers. On the back of them, there's a place for a pass key so the principal can, you know, open the locks if he has to. Lonnie had one of those pass keys. Nobody knew it. So I go to the ring, and when I come back out of the ring, my suitcase is closed, and there's about 10 of those locks on my suitcase. So I can't get in it, and the coach for the sponsoring school comes in, and Lonnie says, "You the coach?" He says, "Yeah." He says, "I'm glad you came back here." He said, "Guy right there," he said, "he's a kleptomaniac." He said, "He's trying to steal all them locks." He said, "There's no telling what's in his suitcase." Well, I'm sitting there, and I don't even know what's going on. Well, the principal or whoever he was comes over and opens all them locks. And when my suitcase opened, there was about 25 brand-new softballs, a couple of baseball gloves. I mean, the bag's full of stuff. And the guy looks at me, and like, I said, "Sir, I have no clue what's going on. He wasn't here when I went to the ring." So Lonnie just sits over and never says a word, you know, never bails me out. So the coach thinks I'm trying to steal half his locker room. But I guess the funniest thing he ever did was we left Columbus TV on a Saturday. It's a Saturday before Christmas. We're closing down. It's the only time of the year we close down. But Christmas was, I don't know, Wednesday or Thursday the next week. So we're closing down for 3 or 4 days. Everybody's going to go home. So the main event in Carrollton that night was Moondog and Dick Slater. And from when we left Columbus, everything was good. When we got to Carrollton, he was knee wobbly drunk. I mean, he was soused. So we get in the ring, and Slater goes, "Can he work?" I said, "I don't know." But as soon as the bell rings, Lonnie becomes Moondog Maine. And I mean, they go into their match. Things are going along well. And the finish is he slams Slater. He's going to climb up to the top rope. He's going to miss a elbow or a leg drop or whatever he was going to do. Slater was going to make a little comeback and pin him. He slammed Slater. He climbed up on the top rope. And when he was up there, he began to fall backwards. His knees never bent. He fell like a tree. I'm standing there watching him. And as I'm watching, it was like it was happening in slow motion. And there was nothing I could do to help him. Slater can't help him. He fell backwards, and he went down out of sight to the floor. I looked down at Slater, and Slater looked up at me and went, "He's dead." And I said, "Yeah, maybe." I walked over, and I remember dreading going over to look because I didn't know what I was going to see. I walked over, I looked down on the floor, he is laying on the floor, and he's laughing. And he looked up at me, and he went, "Bobby, would you count me out, please?" I said, "Not a problem." Gave him a 10 count, turned around, raised Slater's hand, and we went home for Christmas. But I know he fell 12 feet, but he was so drunk, he just laid there.
Well, so. I know you worked a bunch with Rocket Monroe. Was Sputnik Monroe around at all?
Never was in the ring with Sputnik. When I was a kid, matter of fact, first match, as I said, was in February of 64. In March of 64, Sputnik came to Atlanta. His first night in Atlanta, he worked with a guy named Guy Taylor. He hardweighed Guy Taylor. Of course, I didn't know what a hardway was back then. But there was so much blood. I've never seen anything like it. I absolutely was terrified of Sputnik Monroe. Rocket came in to Atlanta, him and his partner Flash, who was Gene Sarazen, was working as his brother, Flash. They came into Atlanta, and I was 14 years old, and me and Rocket just absolutely hit it off. For whatever reason, me and him hit it off. We became lifelong friends. And it was crazy. My mother, who thought I was nuts for hanging out in the wrestling business all the time, didn't like none of them. She liked Rocket for whatever reason. She developed a rapport with him, and she would let me. I would spend more time at his house than I would at home. So from the time I was 14 until he died about 4 years ago or 5 years ago, we were the best of friends. Never had a hard word between us. Matter of fact, the last conversation we had was on the Saturday before he died Monday. He had been in the hospital a few days, and he called. He says, "I didn't tell you because I knew you'd run up here, and ain't nothing you can do." And the last thing we said to each other was, "I love you, bud." And he told me, you know, it's just, we had that kind of relationship. But Sputnik, I got to know at reunions. I told him, I said, "I was afraid of you as a kid." I said, "I'm still afraid of you." And, of course, you know, he laughed about it. But Rocket was just a heck of a guy. But probably one of the best friends I ever had in the wrestling business. You know, I had a lot of acquaintances, but he was a friend. We had, a couple things with him. We were going to make the TV one Thursday, and we stopped at this little diner. It was an old single-wide mobile home, and you went in one door, you placed your order, and then you couldn't walk straight. You had to walk sideways down to the next window to pick your order up and then out another door. And, we got our hamburgers, jumped on the interstate, and went on the way to make a TV. We're running late. We're going to, you know, it's going to be close. And he looks over at me, and he goes, "Does your hamburger taste funny?" And I said, "Well, no, it's just a greasy hamburger." He said, "Mine tastes funny." I said, "Well, let me see it." So I took it, and I took a bite. I thought about it a minute, and I laid it down on my leg, and I opened it up. They had given him two hamburgers with the works, mustard, ketchup, onions, lettuce, tomato. They didn't put any meat on them. So, needless to say, we were late for TV because he made me turn around and go back. But, funny guy. He was, Rocket was from Memphis, Tennessee. He was as country as cornbread, and his voice did not match his body. And that's why you never heard him do many interviews. He always came out with this little shrill, high-pitched voice, but tough as nails, and I miss him tremendously. But, he was a good guy.
When Jerry Blackwell was first breaking into the industry, you know, him being a Georgia boy, I believe he worked for Ann Gunkel Enterprises. Did you work with him at all back then?
Sure did. He started with Ann. He would come to TV to start with. One Saturday on TV, somebody hit him. He backed up. Jerry was short. Jerry wasn't very tall, and he backed into the ropes and he sat down on the bottom rope. And when he did, he leaned back on the middle rope, and he was so short, the rope just kind of went across his head. And as it went across top of his head, it slingshotted him backwards down to the floor. He went out head first backwards to the floor.
Oh man.
Here's another one of those instances where I'm pushing whoever he's wrestling back, thinking, you know, he's dead. I turn around, and he's climbing back in the ring. I finish the match. We go out of the ring, go back to the dressing room, and Ernesto was waiting on us as we opened the door. He said, "Boy," he said, "I thought you was dead." He said, "You landed on your head." And Jerry's remark, he was country too. Jerry's remark was, "Well, I've always been stout about my head and shoulders." That was all he said. But, they put a mask on him. He became, I don't remember what they called him, but we had a wrestling bear come in here, and he wrestled the bear every night. Every town we went to, he wrestled the bear. The funniest thing that ever happened with me and him, we were in a little spot show one night, and he was wrestling somebody, and he was the heel, and he hit the guy, and the guy went out on the floor, and he went out after him. And normally I'd stand in the ring and count, but for whatever reason this particular night, I went out on the floor too. And I pushed him, I separated him, I told him, I said, "Get back in the ring and leave this guy alone." Well, he started away from me, but I just knew what he was going to do. It was just one of those things where your mind said, hey, he's fixing to do something. So as he's going, I start chasing him to try to make him get back in the ring. And as we rounded the corner of the ring where the timekeeper's table was and the bell was, there was a hammer laying there they were hitting the bell with. He picked that hammer up, and we rounded the corner, and on the far end of the ring was a deputy sheriff sitting there working security. And as we rounded the corner, this deputy sheriff unholstered, pulled a .357 out and pointed it at us.
Oh,
and
man.
And what he said was, there will be no hammers in Noonan, Georgia. So Jerry drops the hammer. We roll into the ring, and we come up facing each other. And if we'd choreographed this, we'd have screwed it up. But we stood up, we looked at each other, and we both went, there'll be no hammers in Noonan, Georgia. But you get a gun pulled on you working. These guys, evidently he was a believer. But Jerry was a good guy. We lost Jerry way too soon.
You mentioned working with Wayne Cowan earlier. What was a young Dutch Mantel like?
Tough as nails, hot-tempered. I worked many, many matches with him and Ted. I worked a lot of matches with him and everybody. He was, we made some trips together. Wayne was a pleasure to be around. He was a heck of a guy. He's 3-4 years older than me. Ted was 3-4 years older than me. I love being in the ring with these guys. And they thought outside the box. They did some things sometimes that people would say, oh, that's crazy, but it worked if it was done right. And just a quick example, we were somewhere one night, and Wayne's in the ring, I'm in the ring, and Ted comes out to get in the ring, and Ted had told me, he said, take a folding chair and set it beside the ring, and he said, use it to step up in the ring and leave it there. So I did. So when Ted comes out, he goes to step in the chair. He kicked the chair out from under himself and took a bump and started selling his back. And I jump out on the floor, and, I'm like, he can't continue. He ain't going to be able to wrestle. And Wayne just raises Kane. Ted, of course, being a babyface, once he got the sympathy, he crawls in the ring, and Wayne just proceeds to pound on that back and pound on that back. Now, kicking a chair out from under you and taking a bump before you get in the ring, people say, oh, look at that clumsy oaf. To begin with, they laughed, but then all of a sudden they realized he was hurt because he sold it properly. Those kind of things. Another time they put him in a series of 2 out of 3 fall matches. Gave the instructions in the middle of the ring. Wayne turns around and goes back toward the corner. Ted follows him. Doesn't charge him, doesn't jump on him, he follows him. I ring the bell. Wayne turns around. Ted small packages him. 1, 2, 3. First fall lasts 3 seconds. People say, well, that's crazy. Well, no, it was believable because it was done the right way. So they were fun to be with. And Wayne was a smart guy. He went on to be a pretty good booker and made some money as a booker. But he learned his craft. And him and Tom were big buddies. And him and Tom talked a lot of wrestling. So he was always fun to be around.
Something we've talked about on a previous episode of this show is someone who I'm not sure if you were around after you broke in 69, but it may have been someone who you saw as a fan. But we have talked about Mario Galento and his wife, Smokey, pulling a gun on wrestlers regularly in Atlanta until the office forced him to smarten her up. But do you have any memories of Mario Galento?
I never met Mario. Never was in the ring with him. Never met him. However, me and Smokey were good friends. I met her through the wrestling reunion. As a matter of fact, I saw her the year she died. She was at the Gulf Coast reunion. Mario was inducted into the Gulf Coast Hall of Fame, and she was there to accept the award. She had her son with her. He's an attorney, and she came over and sat with me, and we talked a while. I heard a lot of stories about her pulling guns on people and just doing all sorts of crazy stuff. She even wrestled some, and but sweet lady. But she was defending her man. That was the way she put it. She said, I didn't know any better, and she said, I just did what I had to do to protect him. But I never got to meet Mario. He was a big heel in Atlanta. He had a big run here. When I was a kid, must have been around 69, I guess, somewhere in there. He had a big run here, big feud with Buddy Fuller, but I never had the pleasure to be in the ring with him. And from what I've heard from some of the other guys, it was probably a good thing I wasn't. They said that he wasn't everything you thought he was. So, but God rest him. He was another character that came down the pike. Yeah, that's funny. That's the thing missing from the business today. There's no characters anymore. Everybody's a cookie cutter, and you know Mario would have never made it in today's world, but in that world he was quite a figure.
I asked you earlier just how big Thunderbolt Patterson really was to Georgia wrestling. Same question, but about Mr. Wrestling too.
Oh goodness. The Wrestling 2 phenomena started during the war. They brought him in here. He was working as a grappler in Florida. They brought him in here as Mr. Wrestling 2 to be Tim Woods' partner. Tim Woods was the biggest, here again, as I was growing up, Tim Woods was the first masked babyface that I ever remember. He was a Leo Garibaldi creation here in Atlanta, and Tim was so over here, it was unreal. You guys might know the story where Tim got his finger bit off in Columbus, Georgia on a Wednesday night by a fan. And that Friday night he was wrestling Gene Koninsky for the World Heavyweight title. And they ran a story in the paper on Friday morning about the finger being bit off. It was just was well known. Everybody knew it was real. And the finish of that world title match, is I've remembered it all these years, because Tim Woods had the upper hand the first 35 minutes of the match, and at about the 35-minute mark, Gene Koninsky grabbed that finger, and he worked it, and he worked it, and he worked it, and Garibaldi stopped the match. He was a referee. He stopped the match. Tim Woods never gave up. Garibaldi took all the heat for stopping the match, and then on TV the next day, you know, Tim comes out and goes, "Hey, I respect the referee's decision. You know, I hate it happened that way, but, you know, that's what it was." But when they brought John in as Wrestling 2, that was what to be his partner. And he was instantly over, instantly. As they worked an angle where they actually worked against each other for a while, had a great interview on Atlanta TV where they actually took a hatchet and drove it into the desk and say, "We're burying the hatchets," which was a great interview. But John became the premier babyface in this territory for a lot of years. All you had to do was put his name on a poster and you were going to draw a house. He was that over. He protected his gimmick. He was very protective of it. They all guessed, they all thought they knew who he was, but it was one of those things where they were never sure because he protected it that well. And it was until some of these fan fests here recently that he ever appeared around here without that mask. So he was very over. I mean, he was very over. And, you know, Ole decided one time he was going to retire him. He said, "You know, you've been here too long. We're going to put you in retirement. And we're going to bring you in to do some commentary and this and that and this and that." And that didn't last long because the people wanted him, and he came back. And every time he came back, he just made more money. The only time he ever did anything that I wished he had thought about, they did we had a guy here in Georgia. His name was Joe Powell. Joe Powell was working the little independent shows, and he was working them as Wrestling too. And somehow one of our guys happened to see him. This guy was a spitting image of John. When you put that mask on him, they could walk down the hall together or pass each other. You couldn't tell them apart. You didn't know who you were talking to unless they opened their mouth. So they worked the angle. John was working for Bill Watts out in the South some, and they worked the angle where Joe Powell would come on TV as Wrestling too. He'd work a house show as Wrestling too. Nobody was the wiser, none. Until one Saturday he's in the ring and John walks out, and they just stare at each other. There could have been so much money made with this angle, so much. I mean, it could have went around the territory. It could have lasted for weeks. And they booked him in the Omni against each other. And Johnny said, "John, please don't kill this guy." He said, we got a lot of money here. Let's do the deal and let's continue it and we'll make some money. But John was so protective of that gimmick, he went out and just ate this guy's lunch, just ate him up. And when it was over, the gimmick was dead. Even, I mean, he didn't unmask him, but it was over. People knew, you know, there was no way you could bring it back because people knew that there was no way this guy could beat the real wrestling too. So I wish he had thought about that because there'd have been a whole lot of money there available for everybody. But
yeah,
he was just that protective of his gimmick.
You know, we've mentioned a bunch of different bookers. How did you feel Buck Robley and Robert Fuller did in that job?
Robert Fuller, I love. I've been around Robert a long time. Robert's friend. I love Robert. I think Robert was a little overwhelmed with it. Booking Atlanta was different than booking anywhere else in the world because of the TV. This TV was so strong. And you had to be careful how you booked it and what you did with it. And, you know, I just think he was a little overwhelmed. He was not very successful as a booker here. He brought in Stan Frazier as Plowboy Frazier, and he teamed him up with him and Robert teamed up, and they were in the main event sub, and people just didn't buy it. And, not necessarily Robert's fault. Robert was a good booker everywhere he went, but I just think he was a little overwhelmed here. Buck Robley, same thing. I think Buck was a little – he made so much money as watch booker in Oklahoma, and he thought he would come in here and everything would be just the same. But this was just a rare breed of animal here, and just neither one of them were very successful, and neither one of them lasted very long.
So something that's a big part of the legend of Mr. Wrestling, too, since we just talked about him, was the TV ratings he drew. I mean, what do you remember about, if not the TV ratings, if that wasn't something you dealt with on a regular basis, just how big he was in Atlanta and the rest of the territory in Georgia, not just to wrestling fans, just people on the street, that type of thing?
Everybody knew him. I mean, I can't really explain it. Yeah. Everybody knew. I mean, he wore, like I say, he protected the gimmick. Nobody knew who he was. We could go out and eat together. Me, his family and me would, I was a season ticket holder for the Atlanta Falcons for many, many years. We would go to football games together. People didn't know who he was. We went to the Ringling Brothers Circus together. His family, my family. Nobody knew who he was. His neighbors thought he sold insurance for a living because they'd see him leave, you know, in the evenings, you know, and well, I got appointments. We had one guy, we rode together quite a bit. I was very careful who I rode with. Just being perfectly frank and honest, if I was going to jail, it was going to be because I did something stupid, not because somebody decided to smoke dope or get drunk or whatever. So I was very careful who I rode with. So I made a lot of miles with Ronnie West and John Walker. And we would ride together, especially on Wednesdays. We parked at the same place. The guy there thought we were yacht salesmen. We told him we had to go to Panama City every week and check our inventory. I mean, they just, you know, nobody knew who he was. But put that mask on, and people clamored to him. They wanted to be around him. He was just, he kind of had that magnetic personality. And it was the mask. It was the aura of wrestling, too, because people believed him. People believed in that knee lift. And I can attest, if you ever took one of them knees, you believed in that knee too. I mean, it would just knock you silly. It was, but people believed it. And I really don't know what caused it or what, but just people believed in him. And yeah, TV ratings were good. I'll give you a story about the TV. Bill Watts was booking, and we had a match in the Omni between Harley Race, who was the champion at the time, and wrestling too. And I forget what finish they used, but 2 won the match, and then the belt got taken away on a technicality of some sort. I don't remember what it was, but they filmed it. We put it on Atlanta TV. So Watts came up with the idea of having a champion of Champions Cup. We bought this big, huge trophy. We paid several hundred dollars for it. And we presented it to Wrestling 2 as Champion of Champions. That was a Watts idea. Well, the only problem with that is NWA bylaw says you cannot recommend, you cannot recognize any champion to supersede the world heavyweight champion. And of course they had made this out to be, well, you beat the NWA world champions or you're champion of champions. So anyway, it just set up a return to get rid of the trophy, to get Harley to win the match, to get rid of it. So we get rid of the trophy and we get that out of the way. Then we say, who would you, the fans, like to see wrestle Harley Race for the title the next time the champion's here? Now, the whole reason for doing this was this. We were about to begin the tours going up north. We wanted to find out where the most letters would come from. We had no idea the amount of mail we would get. A U.S. mail truck would back up to the office door every morning and would unload sacks of mail. I'm talking hundreds of letters per sack. And they would throw 10, 12, 15 of those sacks in the middle of the floor. We hired somebody to come in and to open these mail sacks. And all they had to do, they didn't have to open them. All they had to do was check the postmark. Well, of course, 90-1 was Columbus, Ohio. We had strong ratings there, and that's where we got the most mail from. We began to open the letters. Every letter to a person was Mr. Wrestling 2, Mr. Wrestling 2, Tommy Rich, Mr. Wrestling 2, Tommy Rich. We finally wound up going to Columbus, Ohio. It was our first town we ran up north. And it was all because of this letter campaign. But I think the main event that night might have been Tommy Rich and Harley for the title. But Wrestling 2 was in the semifinal. And just, we sold out that building in 13 minutes when the tickets went on sale. So it was just, I don't know what it was. It's just, it was one of those things. I guess, you know, I mean, as a fan from the South, I never got Bruno in New York. I never got why people adored him like they did. But I guess up there, why would somebody adore a guy with a white mask? But that's what happened. That's the way he was. And I got news for you. You can still bring him into town now for an independent show and advertise he's going to be there, and you'll draw 300-400 people.
So there's part three of our discussion with Bobby Simmons. Part four will be airing in 2 weeks here on the program. And you heard a little bit there about the expansion into Columbus, Ohio, and the beginning of Georgia Championship Wrestling, traveling to the places where TBS was broadcasting the show. I believe in the next part, on part four, which is the final segment of with Bobby Simmons, you'll hear a little bit about the dealings they had with the Sheik. And all the problems they had co-promoting with the Sheik. And I think people will really dig that. But Bix, you know, one of the big takeaways from this is just the story of how big Mr. Wrestling 2 really was in Georgia.
Yeah, I mean, the big story that everyone's familiar with, of course, would be, you know, Ms. Lillian Carter and how Wrestling 2 was her favorite wrestler. And then, have you ever heard how much the whole Wrestling 2 was going to wanted to go to the inauguration or was invited or whatever thing was true, but he couldn't go because of the mask? Like, I actually, now I feel bad we didn't ask about that.
Yeah, well, you know, we have his phone number.
Yes, but have you ever heard, like, what the truth is with that?
I heard that he was invited and they said he couldn't wear the mask, so he didn't go.
So the kayfabe version is what you've always heard was the case.
That is.
Okay.
But, you know, it didn't come from Johnny Walker or Lillian Carter, so who knows what the truth really is.
Can I just, as a side note, tell a great Mr. Wrestling 2 story?
Absolutely, go.
So several years ago, I don't remember exactly when this was, Mr. Wrestling 2 Johnny Walker was connected with a wrestling school in Hawaii, because that's where he settled a long time ago. And I want to say it might have been Dick Morocco? What the hell am I talking about? Don Morocco's promotion.
Yeah, where's your mind at, Cal Rudman?
<All right. laughs> Don Morocco's promotion, but I'm not sure. It might not have been. And they were talking about in these ads, like how he's looking for a protege to make Mr. Wrestling 3 and all that stuff. And one of the hooks was, you know, maybe you could be wrestling, Mr. Wrestling 3, but I don't have a lot of time left, you know. So basically the idea was, you got to go to Mr. Wrestling 2's wrestling school for a chance at becoming Mr. Wrestling 3 before he gets too old and dies.
Jesus.
Isn't that great?
I remember one of the weird things he did in Mid-South was when he turned heel, he announced he was number 2 to nobody, and Mr. Wrestling 2 became Mr. Wrestling 1, and then Mr. Wrestling 3 became Mr. Wrestling 2, and that was Hercules Hernandez.
Correct.
Which was just such a weird thing. The guy had been Mr. Wrestling 2 for years, and all of a sudden now he changed his name.
You know what's fascinating about Hercules Hernandez, too? His early role in these various tag teams is the big bumping guy, younger guy, teaming with the older guy.
Yeah, the Assassins.
And then here with Wrestling 2. And then his career just went in the complete opposite direction.
Yeah. Well, then he became a Sheik. Remember, he was a Sheik for a little while.
That was with Akbar?
With Akbar, yeah. Jim Cornette sold his contract to Akbar, and all of a sudden he's wearing the turban or the headdress, whatever exactly it was.
But he didn't revolt against being sold that time like he did in the WWF.
But every single territory – well, let's see. In AWA, you had Sheik Adnan El-Casey, and he got Ken Patera and Jerry Blackwell to be his Sheiks, which is just so funny. And then in the WWF, Iron Sheik was there, and somehow Fred Blassie became Ayatollah Blassie.
Yes.
And then in Mid-South, Hercules Hernandez all of a sudden had a Sheik headdress on. And
he was Sheik Skandar Akbar. Hernandez.
And then Skandar Akbar was running around causing trouble. Where else? Was there anywhere else that they did this? How did Memphis miss out on this fun?
As far as like white cheeks?
Yeah.
Well, Jack Kruger was the Iranian assassin, but he was supposed to be – the gimmick was that he was Iranian.
Yeah, he looked it. He didn't look like, you know, just an average white guy. He's my favorite of those like WWF referees from the late 80s just because he looks so cheap.
He looks like a caricature of a combat sports referee.
Yeah. He cracks me up every time I see him.
You know, apparently he still drives the ring truck.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. That's surprising.
What? That he's still alive?
That he's still employed by them. Okay. Yeah. That surprises me.
Well, they have started to lay off some guys who were there forever, too. So I guess it is kind of surprising, like, that they didn't Mark Eaton him.
Yeah. No, they Steve Lombardied him.
Is that a euphemism? Well, it is a euphemism. Is it a euphemism for something?
Yeah, maybe that's for the homophobia in wrestling episode that we do in the coming weeks. It's time to close out the show. Before we get to the plugs, I want to say a couple things. Obviously, a lot of people have reached out to me and obviously, quite frankly, 99-1 shown wild support for everything that went down last week with Lance Storm. Let me just fill this in. And then after this, it's kind of over. So on Jim Cornette's show a couple weeks ago, we did a WrestleMania review. Jim didn't watch the show. Jim went to Dallas for WrestleMania weekend, did his show, and then stayed in a hotel at the hot tub for the entire weekend. He didn't socialize with anyone in wrestling. He didn't watch any wrestling. He didn't do anything with wrestling. He did his show, stayed in a hotel all weekend, and then did Jim Ross's live show, and then he came back home. So he didn't see any of it. So he wanted to review it, and I went over the show with him, and I expressed my thoughts about modern-day Chris Jericho. I'm not a fan of his current work. I used to be a real big fan of him, and I just don't think he's very good anymore. And also, you know, I've heard different things from different people about how he has a lot of influence with Vince, how he's cultivated that relationship, how he has a certain agent on his side at all times, and that when he sees someone who has some something positive happening to him, he immediately tries to attach himself to that person, get married for a feud, and then he has all these suggestions of things he wants to do. And in my eyes, they're not good suggestions, because I thought the AJ Styles feud was a disaster in my eyes. This is, again, my opinion. And I talked about his work, and I talked about how whatever it is that's wrong with his chest is distracting to me as someone who's been watching him for years. I stand by all that. So his former tag team partner, Lance Storm, you know, if you don't know who this guy is, he was his tag team partner in 1994 at Smoky Mountain Wrestling.
Come on, no. Brian.
Yeah, okay, Jim Cornette. He was his partner in 1994 in Smoky Mountain Wrestling, and then they really didn't do anything together ever again. You know, Lance Storm was a guy who, when everyone was getting contracts, he was like one of the last guys to get contracts with a major company. And then he was there for a few years and he just never did it for me. You know, he's one of these guys I'd watch and he looked like a guy trying to be a wrestler as opposed to a wrestler. His moves were just incredibly fake looking and soft. And like technically he was okay, I guess. Like, I'm sure he's okay in his wrestling school. I'm sure if you want to teach a kid a headlock, he's great. I'm sure if you want to learn how to do a hip toss, he probably knows what he's doing. But in terms of being
I'll just interrupt to say that as far as – just a second. That as far – everything I've heard about him as a teacher and teaching how to bump safely and do everything – and that like all the things that you'd actually want from a wrestling school, because a wrestling school is not where you learn to work. A wrestling school is where you learn how to do things mechanically, that he's phenomenal. But go ahead.
No, I'm not going to use the word phenomenal, but I just basically made that point that I'm sure that's what he's actually good at.
Yes,
but as a professional wrestler in front of the camera, the guy fucking sucked. The guy couldn't do any promos. I mean, I was at Smoky Mountain Wrestling in 94 when he was supposed to do a promo about his partner being hurt, and he couldn't – he kept mistaking the word brother for partner. And he'd be like, my brother – I mean, my partner. My brother – my partner. He couldn't get over. And, you know, he also couldn't get over there. He's a guy there to attract young fans, and every day he'd be standing at the gimmick table. He brought his wife to every show, and then he didn't want to smile. He would just be there like all grumpy. And, of course, he didn't get over, and, of course, he was gone in a few months. So I've never been a fan of his. And after I made my comments about Chris Jericho, he went on Twitter and he called me some names. He called me an asshat, which is incredibly creative. He called me a dick and he called me a dickhead. So, you know, all within the same little space there. And that was it. I thought it was silly. The funny thing is how I found out about it. I found out about it because I don't follow Lance Storm on Twitter. I don't know why anyone would. The guy is the personality of a tree stump. There's nothing he has to say that's at all interesting or exciting or enlightening. Nothing. The guy's nothing. He's a zero. I don't follow him on Twitter, but apparently the Twitter account of Yo Mamba the Jungle Savage does. So all of a sudden I get tagged in a tweet defending me from Yo Mamba. And of course, being from this parody account that someone created for Yo Mamba the Jungle Savage, it's something along the lines of like, I will eat your wife, you know, Brian Last is better than you, blah, blah, blah. So that's my favorite thing, is that I found out about through Yo Mamba the Jungle Savage. So I wasn't going to respond to it. I figured, you know, I really don't care what Lance Storm thinks. The guy's an idiot. And when we were getting ready to Jim Cornette Experience, Jim asked me if I would talk about it. And I said, Jim, I am more than happy to talk about it if you want me to, but I'm going to tell you the truth. I haven't tweeted back at him. I haven't brought this up. If you want me to talk about it, the guy hit me. I'm going to hit him back. And that's really the way I've always lived my life. I was taught from a very young age. If someone hits you, if someone bullies you, if someone picks on you, if someone hits you, you hit them back and you hit them back harder. And if someone hits you with insults, you hit them with the truth. And that's what I did on the Jim Cornette Experience. I said the truth about Lance Storm. A truth that may not be something he wanted to hear. Apparently, he had a meltdown after he heard it. But I said the truth about him. And I stand by everything I said there. And quite frankly, he got what was coming to him for calling me names on Twitter all of a sudden. So what I want to address here, you know, this is pretty much over. Jim doesn't want to talk about it on his show anymore because he actually likes Lance for some reason. And he doesn't want Lance to have his feelings hurt again by my counterpunch, as it were. But Lance wrote this entire giant missive about the thing, and I just want to say a few things about that. First of all, for everyone who has asked if what I said last week on the Jim Cornette Experience was said after Lance issued his missive about Balls Mahoney's passing, which was just ignorant and you know, really just insulting. I mean, when a guy dies and you issue a statement about how hard you tried to avoid him, what's the point of that? Why write that down? You know, there's 100 different ways he could have written that where it wasn't so insulting. No, I hadn't seen that. I hadn't heard that. We didn't know Balls Mahoney was dead when we recorded the Jim Cornette Experience. So everyone that was up in an uproar about Lance Storm's comments about that and thought I was kind of piggybacking on that. No, I recorded my segment about him before that even came out. Second, he issued this giant missive about, you know, his problems with what I said, calling me Mr. Co-host the whole time, which I fell in love with right away. I told Jim on the show that I now want him to call me Mr. Co-host on the Jim Cornette Experience because I actually thought that was funny. I also learned that asshat apparently is capital A S S hyphen capital H A T. So that's an interesting thing to learn. You know, basically in every paragraph of his missive from the Oblivion, he was begging to come back on the Jim Cornette Experience. In every single paragraph, I was like, I'd be happy to come on the Jim Cornette Experience and discuss this if, you know, this, this, and this. Every single paragraph. Because the guy's begging for attention. The same reason he has a Twitter account where he tweets out stupid stuff. He says he didn't listen to the show. I don't buy that at all. The guy's an egomaniac. The guy's self-absorbed. You know, case in point, that Balls Mahoney missive, which was completely self-centered. He absolutely listened to the show. He probably listened to it about 100 times. Probably listens to it on a loop, quite frankly. He said he didn't want to get caught up in a childish Twitter war, that so he was going to just, you know, address it here and never address it again. Let's set the record straight. You started a childish Twitter war. You went on Twitter and you called me a bunch of names. I didn't tweet you back. I responded when Jim Cornette asked me to respond. And then I hit you a lot harder than you hit me, but I hit you with the truth. And you know what? Next time you want to call someone names, think about it twice. Think about it a couple times. And, you know, of course, Twitter lit up with this. The hashtag CuntylandStorm went on fire. Someone created a CuntylandStorm Twitter page, a picture of a vagina with Landstorm's face in the middle of it, which is hysterical. And, you know, the one thing I'm happy about, my gift to the world, is the next time this guy with a long track record of texting or tweeting out ignorant, stupid, self-centered stuff, and acting like he's Mr. Know-It-All, I'm glad the hashtag CuntyLandStorm is out there now for the world. Because the next time he does something dumb, that hashtag is going to escort him wherever he's going. And, you know, he's incapable of any sort of self-realization. You know, I read this missive that he wrote, and, you know, basically he's accusing me of being wrong about a whole number of things, while at the same time admitting he doesn't know about any of those things. It's like, I suspect he's wrong, but if I'm wrong, I will apologize. Like, it's just, you are wrong. You know, I understand. I said things about your former tag team partner and your friend that you didn't like, and then you acted like a child. Get over it, pony boy. And this whole thing of, he suspects I don't know anything about, well, let me explain something to you, Landstorm. You have no idea who I talk to in the wrestling business. Other than me appearing on Jim Cornette's Experience, you have no idea who I talk to in the wrestling business, specifically in the office. You have no idea. And I don't have to prove myself to you because you're a complete zero, a human gutter ball. But you have no idea what I know. Let me just say that. And with that, I think it's just about over. It was a squash match. The job guy got a few hits in, and then he took my finishing maneuver and he went out on a stretcher, and he'll probably never be seen again. But that's
like
it.
Like Jack Kruger.
He'll be driving the ring truck to Oblivion. But I just wanted to say those few things. And, you know, unless something turns up, I really don't have anything more to address with this. Like I said, I defended myself. And I suggest anyone out there do that. If we have any young listeners and someone picks on you or bullies you or goes on social media with a huge social media following, he has like, you know, 200,000 Twitter followers or something, and he's calling me names. You know what? Fight back. Counterpunch. And like I said before, I learned at a very young age, when someone hits you, you hit them back harder. And when someone hits you with insults, hit them with the truth. Because the truth hurts if you're not prepared for it. And with that, it's time for plugs, Bix. What do you got going on this week?
I don't even know anymore.
Oh, Jesus. Don't get so dramatic. I'll bring the Black Scorpion back.
One thing I do want to add to your speech.
Yes.
It is kind of funny about all this, and maybe it's why he didn't really say anything about your comments about his work. He has joked on Twitter about how terrible his punches and stuff were.
It's more than the punches, but
I know. Yeah. I'm just saying.
CuntyLandStorm. That's not going away. So he better watch his behavior. That's all I'll say.
Maybe we should give him the Kindle Unlimited code since he hates library so much.
Anyway, Bix, what do you got going on this week, other than your sickness, whatever it is that's inflicting you?
The sickness.
You need the wellness.
Maybe not this week after what happened with the wellness.
Well, we'll see how that turns out, but what's going on?
This week on Between the Sheets, me and Chris Ullner actually did not have a guest due to some scheduling issues, so it was the two of us covering 1996, with the top story being Brian Pillman's car accident, among some other things, including the, you know what, speaking of AIDS and what we talked about earlier, we we cover the WWF Superstar line tease where Jim Ross pushed that we would find out what Davey Boy Smith and Magic Jordan.
Boy, you really don't watch sports, do you?
I knew I misspoke. I know. Magic Johnson. You know what it is? I've seen all these crying Jordans lately, and I keep thinking Michael Jordan when I think basketball.
Picks. No. Name one member of the Knicks.
Patrick Ewing.
Well, you know, he's not a current Knick, but I'll give you credit for that.
He didn't say current Knicks.
Okay.
John Starks.
Wow. So now I can basically tell you, like, when they were on that championship run, when OJ was on the run, that was the last time you watched a Knicks game.
And with good reason.
Yeah. Well, you know what? As a Knicks fan, you're not wrong. But anyway.
Where the hell was it? Oh, so what do Magic Johnson and Davey Boy Smith have in common besides being professional athletes? That was an actual hotline plug, which I thought was a Mean Gene plug. But
what was the answer to that?
Oh, I forgot already. It was something stupid.
Do we know?
Not AIDS.
Okay.
Why did you think it was AIDS?
No, but I'm just wondering how that tease pays off. I mean, do they both own a chain of movie theaters? No. Let's see. What else could it be? I have no idea what that could be. Did they both sleep with Paula Abdul? I don't think so. Did they both hang out with Arsenio Hall? Probably not. I don't know what it could be.
I'm surprised that you think that Davey Boy Smith never hung out with Arsenio Hall.
Why would he? I think Arsenio Hall.
Why wouldn't he?
I don't know. I don't see that happening. Was he ever on the Arsenio Hall show? I know, you know, so many other guys were. I don't know if British Bulldog was.
He would have missed it, I think, because he came back like right when they were done with Arsenio. And
then he went off the air in 94, so.
And then he stopped kind of having wrestlers on the last few years for some reason.
That's one of my favorite things. When I was at Fan Week and New Jack gave that speech in Knoxville, and he said, you know, first you guys silenced Medgar Evers, and then you silenced Martin Luther King, and now you even silence Arsenio Hall. It's just such a funny line in the middle of a passionate promo.
So, yes, that is on the PWO-PTBN network. Do I have anything else to plug this week? Really? Or not really. Nothing too big. Although, there is something from last week, in case people didn't see it by now, that I guess I probably pissed off Hulk Hogan. Probably. I would think I did, wouldn't I? Wouldn't you?
Yeah, I think so.
I don't know this for a fact, person.
But at the same time, I feel like the staff of Gawker were all high-fiving each other in the name of Bix and Span.
That's probably true. I haven't asked any of my friends there, but that's probably true. It turns out that some audio, including his not-so-nice comments about the black people, had actually been unsealed, and I procured them, and that, of course, that was the big thing on the whole audio, which was the FBI doing a sting. So I have an article about that with the audio at Death.
You just called that you just called them the black people.
That was the joke, that it's the about, you've never heard that, about someone saying someone doesn't make about the black. That's the whole point, is that it sounds stupid. Oh God.
All right.
You can tell
if I had a machine to make drops, I would have that right now.
That's why I keep it from you and don't tell you how to do it.
That's why I'm downloading that shit today. As soon as the show's over.
Well, and now soon we may have a wrestling promotion that has an official platform that it's not a fan of the Jews either. So,
well, we'll see how that works out. And if there's a way to fit that in and talk about it, we will. But I'm not sure what else there is to say about that right now.
Nothing.
As always, nothing. I'm on the Jim Cornette Experience each and every week. I am his co-host, Mr. Co-host, the great Brian Last. And this week on the show, we have a long talk, Jim and Kevin Sullivan. Really, really cool. Last week's show, besides the Landstorm rant, last week's show had Jim and Ricky Morton, and I think probably the best conversation ever on the Jim Cornette Experience. So if you haven't heard that, check that out. And this week, they have a really great conversation between Jim Cornette and Kevin Sullivan. A lot of Blackjack Mulligan stories and really, really cool stuff. Everyone should go check that out. MLWradio.com. Just download it from iTunes. That's the easiest thing to do. For this show, as Bix said earlier, you can go to Amazon, use our referral link, tinyurl.com/605Amazon. And you pay the same price you would for anything else, but anything you purchase, whether it's soap or light bulbs, maybe you want to get some Airborne, you're feeling sick, maybe some Pepsid AC, maybe you want to get a little ceramic John Lennon. I don't know what you want, but a small, tiny fraction of a percentage will go to us. It helps us keep this show going. It helps us prove to our better halves that we're not wasting our time with this wrestling thing. It does a lot of good. So please, if you enjoy the show and support the show and you purchase things regularly from Amazon, use our referral link, tinyurl.com/605Amazon, to purchase your goods. And that link will be in the show post at 605pod.com. And of course, they have the two bounties, which are tinyurl.com/605Kindle or tinyurl.com/605Prime if you want to try any of those. And please do. It would help us out. On Twitter, you could, of course, use the hashtag 605pod, but you could also go right away to our 605 Super Podcast Twitter page, which is at 605pod. And, of course, Bix and I are both on there. He's at David Bix. I'm at Great Brian Last. Say hello. Join the party. Facebook, the Facebook page, my favorite part of our growing online community, facebook.com/superpodcast. Only a fraction of our listeners have gone on there, but it's a very engaged, active bunch, and I love you guys. And, you know, we have different things. You usually find out what's coming up on the show the day before. We usually have different things. We have, like, a random picture on Sunday. I started doing random ticket stubs on Monday. We have voting for the top 10, various questions that we want to ask the listeners to gauge where you guys are at, what you guys think of what we're doing on the show and things that we're working on, and just various other old-school wrestling goodness. Last week, we posted some stuff from the John McAdam tape catalog for those of you who heard him and wanted to see his old tape listings, which were the best. He had the best tape catalog out there. So you can check that out, facebook.com/superpodcast. Please join our community. Tell a friend. Call somebody.
You know, it's also a very good community, by the way, and one that we'll be talking about next week.
Oh, the gay community. That's
I like how you have Dave Meltzer in the background there trying to jump in and stop it. Well, either next week or the week after. We got to see how we can fit everything in, just because on the topic of upcoming shows, next week is our big show with Michael Hayes audio from 1988 in Dallas, Texas. Everyone loved the audio of him in 1984 as a drunk heel. Now you get to hear him as a single babyface in 1988, right before the concert with him and the Von Erichs.
And to be clear, he is a singles babyface. When you say single babyface, you are referring to his marital status.
Oh, yeah. He's now completely free and single and letting everyone know about it. So we'll have that on the show next week. And we got to figure out exactly how we're going to do it. We said Bobby Simmons part four, the final part, will be in 2 weeks. But we have this amazing John Arezzi conversation that we have to start rolling out. So it may debut as early as next week. We got to figure it out. Just time-wise, I got to see how we can cut it up. But I got to say, I think everyone's going to really love it. And I think especially if you were a wrestling fan who grew up in New York, you're going to go apeshit for this thing, because he covers a lot of stuff and he's at a point in his life where he's very honest about everything, his faults, his successes, his failures. And, you know, John is a great guy and we had a really great time talking with him, and you'll get so much inside information about lots of old stuff from the New York wrestling scene. So if you grew up listening to Pro Wrestling Spotlight, you will love this interview with John. And that, we'll see, Bix. Maybe as early as next week, but if not, definitely within 2 weeks, but possibly as early as next week on the Michael Hayes show, we will have that. I think maybe we will.
Well, and also people who remember when the Wrestling Insider syndicated show suddenly stopped having Mike Tenay and wondered who that guy was, that's also
I forgot about that. That's right.
So mostly New York people, but a little bit. Some other people might know who he was. People know who he was, but the people who will be the most fascinated will be those who listen to his show in its various forms.
I called into the Wrestling Insiders once when Mike Tenay had it, and he had Jim Ross on right after he left WCW in 93, before he went to the WWF. And he always sounds so miserable, like even then, before, like, you know, everything. And I called up and I had a few questions for him. And I was 13, so I was a little stupid. And I called up and I asked him about the WCW light heavyweight division. And he gave me an answer, like how it just went away. And I asked him something else. And then before I hung up, I just said, "Hey, Jim, one last time for all of us fans, can you say so long, everybody?" And he was just like, "Well, maybe later." And then, you know, Mike today was like, "Yeah, Brian, stop telling us what to do on our show." And that was it. Click. But anyway, iTunes reviews. If you can, if you use iTunes, or even if you don't, if you have an account you hacked, whatever it is, go to iTunes, go to 605 Super Podcast, and please leave us a 5-star review and write a review. Let us know what you think of the show. We get some funny ones up there, and we get a lot of ones that are just very complimentary. You know, we work our asses off on this show and really, really do appreciate all the kind words that everyone writes there, and as well as everywhere else. Everyone's been sending us notes with really amazing superlatives about this program. And Bix, why is the iTunes reviews important?
In the event that we ever got onto any kind of chart, I think the reviews help. And also, on that note, please, however you are listening to the show, whether it's iTunes or some other kind of podcast catcher thing, please subscribe. This is something we probably should be stressing more than we have been. Please subscribe. That definitely helps. And that way, as soon as the show goes up, it's downloaded right to your phone, computer, whatever. And you'll have the show right away. And that helps us too, because that way we know that you're going to be downloading it every week. So please check that out. And if you're not using iTunes for your podcast, then the feed to use for the show is feeds.feedburner.com/605pod, which I believe is also linked as in the link that says our RSS feed in the description of every show.
And like we said earlier, I just want to, one last thing before we go. If you are someone who has in the past thought about or done a donation to either Bix or myself, then please this week do not do that. Please instead go to GoFundMe.com/Joe Doering. And again, it's Joe, as you would typically spell Joe, but Doering is D-O-E-R-I-N-G. Joe Doering, former Triple Crown heavyweight champion in All Japan Pro Wrestling, is battling brain cancer. So let's see what we could do to help him out. And please do that this week instead of any donations you would make to Bix or myself. And with that, I think we're about tapped out, Bix.
I think we are. I think we're done.
So next week, Michael Hayes Audio, call somebody because you will love it. And until next time, he's David Bixenspan. I'm the great Brian Last. Tally-ho!
Lance, would you care to compliment on the Nate the Rat
fan? Hey, listen, I got to tell you, I can't wait until the first annual convention of all the fans. The problem is they really haven't been able to find any place that is big enough to get the number of people already that have been recruited in 24 hours. But sooner or later, a story will be released, and it's going to be one of the major things that's happened in wrestling in a long time. Probably the biggest thing since the Wrestling Observer. No
what doubt. A man, Nate the Rat.
That's sugar-coated,
right.
Baby.
That's be right. Nate, let's do it, baby. I get it. That's it, baby. The sign of the Nate the Rat fan club.
You heard it right.